Welcome, brothers, sisters, working class heroes. This is the Rick Smith Show. Thanks for being here tonight on the big program. Our governor, oh, our governor, yes, the foot in the mouth again. And what's great is we haven't even really gotten into campaign season. What I love about our governor is for the longest time I thought he was Punxsutawney Tom. You saw him when they had a little event, and then he went back into his little hole, and you didn't see him for a while. Or he ran, or they jetted him off to Brazil, or they jetted him off to France, I think he went to. He's got some frequent flyer miles. But, you know, here's the thing. Got the foot in the mouth again. So that's going to be fun, Pat. That will be fun to talk about. Again, he's the gift he's like herpes. The gift that keeps on giving.
Maybe he was visiting Mark Sanford. You know, maybe Mark Sanford is
Appalachian Trail.
Yeah.
No, he's not that ambitious.
His travel agent.
Yeah, the one thing that I will never say about Tom Corbett is I don't think he would ever try to have some on the side. He's not going to be that ambitious.
and nobody's going to do that work for him. They'll make them drunk enough.
There you go. Also going to talk about Medicaid expansion, CEO salary again. Where's your paycheck going? Most of us, it's going down. CEOs, again, another record-breaking year. Kids, we're going to talk about them. We're going to talk about workers. We're going to talk about so many things tonight. Get your input, 1-888-520-RICK, 1-888-520-7425. Thoughts, questions, comments, whatever is rattling around between your ears. You can also email me, Rick, at therickSmithShow.com. So today, yes, today was the day, Pat. We took to the streets, went out to Target, went out to JCPenney, went out to Macy's, and yeah, I know you're sad. No Clinique for a while.
I did put the little papers that we handed out. We had these little papers, and there's stuff up on the Facebook page and on the website about it, but this is what it says. These retailers refused to sign the landmark International Labor Organization's Accord on Building and Fire Safety. They don't care who dies as long as you keep shopping there. In April, 1,127 Bangladesh workers died in what was just one of a string of avoidable factory disasters. If you shop with these stores, you are saying it's okay to kill people to make money. And then the stores are listed. Macy's, JCPenney, Sears, Gap, Target, Kohl's, Sears, Kmart, Walmart, The North Face, makers of Wrangler jeans, Carter's, makers of Oshkosh Bagosh, Nordstrom's, where a bra is $400, American Eagle, The Children's Place, and Foot Locker.
Oh, I forgot.
We went into Foot Locker,
well.
Too.
Right.
Yeah, yeah. We went to two Foot Lockers because they even have a Foot Locker for kids.
And what I thought was funny is, as you said, as we were walking into it, you know, made by, you know, the people about the same age as they're going to wear the kids' shoes.
Yeah, it's just awful. So, anyway, it says, blazoned across the top, the Rick Smith Show, went around all these places, and I did put on the Clinique counter some of these little placards.
As you should. Hopefully the people will think about that. And what I found really just amazing is how much red, white, and blue, and how much patriotism, how much chest thumping. We honor the troops. Oh, we love the flag. In fact, there was the one little cute outfit that you looked at yourself that was extraordinarily patriotic.
It would have been adorable on me,
China.
Too.
Made in China.
If I could shop at Macy's anymore,
yeah,
I would have loved it.
But, you know, again, you go back, and every patriotic holiday, I generally try and find people, especially the people with the Constitution shirt and, all the jingoistic stuff that they come out with at the patriotic holidays. And I often go, well, do you know where that's made? You know, because if you're really going to be, to me, if you're really going to be patriotic, shouldn't you kind of just thoughtfully be wondering where that stuff was made and under what conditions? I mean, just a thought.
I think at least under what conditions. Now, someone said to me, where are we going to shop if we can't go to Macy's or JCPenney or Sears or Target or Walmart or Kohl's? Where are we going to shop? And I said, well, you know what? If you say I won't shop unless something's from my local community, businesses will open because that's what business does. This really is capitalism. Those banks weren't too big to fail. If they had failed, that would have been the lesson of capitalism. So the lesson of capitalism is you stop buying stuff based on certain purposes and certain reasons. It's my favorite example of capitalism was when the big rage was burning the flag and the guy in Kansas invented the flame retardant flag.
That was it.
You can't burn it. It won't flame up. So we just stand by your guns for a while and you won't have to worry about anything because they're eventually going to want to get your dollar. And if they have to get your dollar by doing something local and taking good care of people, and you know what? There are nice people, I'm certain, in Bangladesh. If they can get paid $150 a month instead of $38 a month and live in a place and work in a place that's not going to collapse on them. Somebody made the point today to us, and a lot of people were very responsive. I've got to say, a lot of the customers.
Normally, you know, when you go out and you pick it, and you go out and you leaflet, you get a lot of very angry response. This was most of the vast majority of the people I talked to were extraordinarily responsive,
and they had no idea,
no clue.
The mainstream media had completely dropped the ball on letting them know that 1,127 people died, and there were thousands injured. That's the other number, and then couple of weeks later, there was another disaster causing another several hundred people to die. So it's a string of these things, and people had no idea, none. And I thought that was fascinating. And then the other thing that was fascinating was the rage in the people that were throwing us out. I mean, the managers were enraged that they had to throw us out. And
they had to come out of the back room.
No.
The coffee was.
They had to come out of their comfort zone. We made them have conflict. I guarantee to you, every single one of those managers.
And my argument wasn't with them, though.
Of course it's not with them, but they see you. I mean, if their numbers go down, that's not good for them with their boss. But wait a minute. Brett just told me. They're $48 billion. Yep. Target's net worth, $48 billion.
Yep. Well, you mentioned to the one woman who, you know, she was $500 million. Oh, my gosh. $48 billion. One of
the
15.
No, 500,000.
That was 500. Oh, no, 500,000.
It's only 500,000. Each one of the signatories, everyone that signs on, Calvin Klein has signed on, Abercrombie & Fitch has signed on, Tommy Hilfiger has signed on, H&M has signed on. Every single company that signs on to this safety agreement has to put in the kitty to fix the factories $500,000. That's nothing.
Not for a company that's $48 billion?
Not for a company that's paying that for a celebrity model to hawk their sneakers. I mean, $500,000, all those red, white, and blue banners we saw, they spent more than that on the banners for store signage.
And I kind of wonder where those were made. I mean, part of me looks at that as well. I mean, all of this. And you kind of wonder with the kid in China who's sewing that shirt that looked fabulous on you, by the way.
Thank you.
You got to wonder where.
That is the other thing. Try it on, sweat, and leave.
You do have to wonder what that kid in the factory where they've got nets in the hallway so people don't jump off and commit suicide. You've got to wonder what those kids are thinking when they're sewing the American flag on the things. You've got to wonder about that.
Yeah, it's pretty upsetting.
Because I don't know, you know, and maybe it's just me. I would have a serious problem sewing the Chinese flag onto something as my living. At least I think I would.
No, if you're making a living.
But you go back to this. If you're making a living, if you're desperate enough. And to me, I look at a lot of these countries like Bangladesh, they've created this environment where all these people are desperate and they're just exploiting the hell out of it.
Right. It's slavery.
And what you've got is you've got the neoliberals in this country who are saying, well, you know, they should be thankful that we've given them sweatshops. At least they have something. And that they're, I'm sure you've seen the argument.
I've heard the argument. I'm stunned by the word neoliberal. I don't know what that is.
Those are the people who promote these insane free trade agreements.
Oh.
The global people. The people who have said, you know what, have taken and destroyed the Kennedy
thing. Can we just call them neophytes? Because they're idiots.
Well, I mean, the neoliberals, they want open borders. They want one big world. They want everybody to, you know, it just is what it is. They want open borders for trade and open borders for goods and services and all of that, but not quite so much for people.
Well, that was the argument for Bill Clinton gave, right, was when we export all of our jobs to Mexico, that just means Mexicans will get paid better.
Right.
And that was comical. I mean, I tell you what, I had a belly laugh on that one. Yeah, right. That's why we're exporting the jobs, so we can give good-paying jobs to other countries where the jobs don't pay so well. No. It was
but
to go
the
take
neoliberals
advantage
believe
of it.
That. The people who've drank the Kool-Aid, they buy that. They say, no, we're going to lift them up, and we'll all rise together, going back to the Kennedy thing. The rising tide lifts all boats. They think that, you know, if we give them the jobs that pay $20 an hour, they would be wonderfully well off.
But we do give them the jobs that pay $20 an hour, and then we pay them 25 cents an hour.
That's what happened. Yeah. So, like any, you know, as I've said, I've coached football, you know, I've coached sports, and any play I've ever written up, it's always scored. It's always, we've always won on paper. It's like any of these models that you create, and, you know, with these people who live in these ivory towers of these think tanks.
Are you telling me you don't win in real life just on paper?
You know, we're somewhere in the middle, though. But not every time.
Yeah.
You know, you go into the huddle, you draw up the play. Sometimes it works, sometimes it doesn't.
And the other point I think you're making, as I'm being silly, is you're making the point that these plays have disastrous effects when they fail.
Oh, disastrous. And the reality is you hear an awful lot of this. We need to have more. And I heard this when I was down at Disney from a lot of Southerners. And this is why I think organizing and education has to happen in the South at really a breakneck pace. Because I heard several Southerners telling me the problem with the country is we don't have enough competition. And we don't have enough. We have too many regulations. So if we could compete more and have no regulations, we would be fine. And when you look at that world, hyper competition and no regulations, you get Bangladesh.
Exactly, and they have plenty of regulations, by the way, in this country, because we were in a mall, and if we didn't leave, the police were going to get rid of us. Now, does that sound like regulation? That's ultimate regulation. Now, if someone wanted to take my picture and put it on a 19-year-old supermodel's body and put it on a billboard, I couldn't complain because I'm public domain, right?
Right.
I ran for vice president of the United States. I did all this stuff.
Well, why would they need a 19-year-old's body?
Aw, you made me blow my nose. that was sarcastically sweet. Thank you. But how come a mall isn't public domain? How come you can do anything, you can say anything. Your First Amendment allows you to excoriate me or praise me or make me look like a 19-year-old supermodel. Do anything you want because I made myself public domain. How come Macy's didn't make itself public domain?
It's a corporation. It's a person. It's a person with all of the rights that you used to have before you ran for office.
But that's regulation, right? We were regulated right out of existence.
Yep.
Because if we – how about Paul Blart? Who came to get us, huh? Paul Blart comes to get us at the mall over in Harrisburg.
He's going to get my license plate.
He did get your license plate. He walked around until he could get it, and then you did that serpentine, like...
But the thing is, we're handing out things with my name on it, the website. You don't need my license. Like, are you going to be able, Blart, to be able to get that? And, you know, look, it's what he was told. And I got no problem with the security guard. You know, he was doing his job. He could have...
I got no problem with anyone except for that. That's regulation.
Funny,
that's
though.
The damn police state. It was funny. He was so upset, too, because when he told us to leave and we left, but then we started leafleting everybody in the parking lot.
Whenever I talked to the union bus driver, which, you know, she you know... Hey, there's an opportunity to meet up with some people who are doing a really tough job and, you know, give them a little appreciation, a little love. There's nothing wrong with that.
There are a couple of favorites. One of my favorites was the woman who, coming out of Target, says to me, "Oh, no, the big guy gave me one over at JCPenney." So you had already gotten her at Penny's. And I'm like, what are you doing?
Shopping everywhere.
Shopping in all of them? You want to hit the big 15?
There you go. And that's what we need to be doing. We're going to take a quick break. Right back. Stick around. You're listening to The Rick Smith Show. We're working people. Come to talk.
Get up and take your money. All they want to do is get up and take your money. All they want to do is get up and take your money.
You're listening to The Rick Smith Show.
You're listening to WIN, Workers Independent News, a production of Diversified Media Enterprises. I'm Doug Cunningham. AFSCME Medical Center workers in California began a two-day strike Tuesday. Jesse Russell reports.
All five University of California Medical Centers saw picket lines on Tuesday as workers walked off the job over stalled contract negotiations. It was the first day of a planned two-day strike brought on by employees demanding a contract that includes fair wages and an increased commitment to patient safety. Margaret Mann is a hospital lab tech at UC San Francisco's Medical Center.
Since, I think, last June, we've been working without a contract, and the university is They're just not paying attention to any of our concerns at all.
Representatives of the UC system have criticized the strike action as putting patients in the middle of a labor dispute. But Mann said they took the action as a last resort.
You know, as far as the patients in there today, we have to deal with them 365 days a year. You know, we care about them 365 days a year. And if this is the only way we can make things better, and this is the action of last resort, we have tried everything. Nobody wanted to do this.
The workers are represented by the American Federation of State, County, and Municipal Employees, Local 3299. But they weren't the only workers on the strike lines. The University Professional and Technical Workers, Local 9119, launched a sympathy strike and marched along with their co-workers. UPTI workers said they shared the same concerns regarding rising executive salaries, while workers are asked to accept concessions to patient care.
In Washington, D.C., federal workers protesting low wages walked off their jobs at several federal buildings. The workers have organized as Good Jobs Nation. They work for federal contractors at the Ronald Reagan Building, the Smithsonian, Union Station, and other buildings. The federal government is the largest employer of low-wage workers in America, with some 2 million low-wage workers working for the government through contractors paid for by tax money. Those workers want a real living wage. Low-wage workers are rising up, fighting for living wages and union organizing rights all over America, from New York City to Walmart warehouses in California and Chicago to Detroit, St. Louis, and Milwaukee, to name just a few. Jennifer Epps Addison is with the Milwaukee Workers Organizing Committee.
It really just comes from everyday working people who are doing everything they can and doing everything right, doing exactly what they were told they're supposed to do, and yet at the end of the week or at the end of the month, don't have enough to meet their basic needs. They can't keep their rent paid. They can't keep their lights on. And most importantly, they can't take care of their children. And so folks really came together and they started talking about their conditions. We were inspired by what's happening across the country. And so we decided that we needed to turn those poverty wage jobs into good jobs, into jobs that could support a family.
Workers Independent News is made possible in part through underwriting support from the International Brotherhood of Teamsters. You've been listening to WIN, Workers Independent News. For more information, visit laborradio.org.
Hey there, fellow working class heroes. I have some great news. You can now get the Rick Smith Show podcast on your iPhone, Android, BlackBerry, or Palm on demand and on the go. Get your class war to go by downloading the Stitcher app on your smartphone by going to Stitcher.com and search for The Rick Smith Show, or go to our website at TheRickSmithShow.com and click on our Stitcher button. Together we can and we will rebuild a prosperous working class and leave opportunity for our children. You're listening to the best of The Rick Smith Show. Enjoy your holiday.
And I'm proud to say that we are going to support the president, the next president of the United States, by casting 67 votes for Mitt Romney and 5 votes for Paul Ryan.
Welcome back to The Rick Smith Show. Check out the website, TheRickSmithShow.com. Questions, comments, something on your mind, you can email me, Rick at TheRickSmithShow.com. I love that man. He's kind of like Bush to me. The more he comes out of his hole, the more Punxsutawney Tom comes out and peeks and sees his shadow, the more entertaining I find him. Remember the commencement address that he gave, which I just found really very interesting. The audience... nobody interested in what our governor had to say on that in that speech whatsoever. But today, it came out that on Friday, the governor gave a discussion, a little roundtable to the Union League in Philadelphia, where he was asked a pretty simple question: do you have any staff members that are Latino? And this is what the governor had to say:
do you have staff members that are Latino?
No, we do not have any staff members in there. If you can find this one, please let me know.
I'm sure that there are Latinos.
Either one of you want to cut the hair style?
Well, I'm almost deaf on that one. I'll just read it to you. They asked if you have any Latino staff members. He said, nope, don't have any staff members in there. If you can find this one, please let me know. And she said, I'm sure there are Latinos. There are Latinos there. And he said, well, do any of you want to come to Harrisburg and see? Well, here's the reality. There was a survey done in 2008 that said in the Harrisburg-Carlisle area, there are more than 18,000 Hispanics
or folks of Latino origin in this area, a third of which are in the city. In fact, the city of Harrisburg has a Latino Hispanic American community center. And maybe if our governor spent a little time here, maybe he would know that. That's why I've asked our good friend, Attorney Irwin Aronson, to come talk to us a little bit about the latest Tom-ism and, well, the big speech that was. Irwin, thanks for taking time for me.
Good to be here. How are you?
I am good. I look at this, and is this a slip of the tongue, or is this just, I don't know any Latino people?
Well, sadly, it's not a slip of the tongue. It's an evidence, in my view, and it's really very sad and very troubling and downright scary, because we are getting insight into the mindset of the man who is the chief executive of our state. He is being characterized in the news media, and a lot of politicians are making a great deal of fun of this because they're characterizing him as a gaffer, that he has too many slips of the tongue, as it were. But these are not slips of the tongue, in my view, whether it's this most recent one where he tells us how he can't find a Latina that is capable of being around his administration, that he doesn't know of any of them, or the week before last, when he announced to the world that the reason that people are unemployed is that employers in Pennsylvania just seem to be unable to find anybody who's unemployed who isn't on drugs. Or when he stripped people in Pennsylvania not all that long ago, a couple of years ago, of access to health care, this is somebody who, when left on his own, left to his own devices, says these things not because he's making mistakes, but because he's opening us up to the truth of his life, to the truth of his views, to the reality of who he is. And it is very troubling, very scary. This is a scary man who has apparently lived his entire life sheltered from the reality of our society, sheltered from people of color, sheltered from people who are in poverty, sheltered from people who don't have access to medical care, sheltered from people who can't pay the rent, sheltered from people who, as I've said before, have to make choices between medicine and milk and sugar and shoes, sheltered from people who don't look like and act like him, who might actually have talent and have something to offer, and might be able to expand the horizons of his view of the world. And these little squibs of insight into his personality, when measured against his almost insatiable appetite for passing out goodies and taffy and breaks to his business buds, is just one of the most frightening pieces of information that I have been able to see in a long, long time.
You know, I look at this, and you know, you go and you're. I think you're absolutely right. This is a peek into his mind, because you know, when he was running for governor, you know, oh, the only people that I talk to say that they can't find workers because, well, they're lazy was one of the things. And then now it's their drug addicts. And now, you know, even though when he had established a commission on Latino affairs and had a woman that was to head that up, you know, didn't really know her. And I wonder if ever met her. So there's part of me that goes, is it that he keeps himself away, or his handlers have done this?
Well, let's assume that for a moment it's his handlers. Who picked the handlers? You know, this
the people
this
who gave him the money. Drilling industry?
Well, you know, Corbett picks the handlers, and he picks them based upon the people with whom he associates. Somehow or another, he knows how to find somebody to give him tickets to the Steelers game and to the playoffs and to sit in a skybox in the lap of luxury and hang out with his Marcellus Shell driller buddies, who he has given the biggest break to in the entire United States of America. And at the same time, turning his back on children who need an education, turning his back on parents who have to try to figure out a way to buy shoes to send the kids off to school, if there's going to be a school anymore, when he's not passing out our tax dollars to the charter privateers of our education community, and they're really not even part of our education community. They're part of our corporate community that is using education as the model to make their next billion. This is troublesome. This is scary. There's a direct connection between his mindset and these statements. He, every time he gets caught in one of these things, blames, and I'm quoting now, the reporters. Well, apparently, in this guy's mind, there is a conspiracy among the entirety of the news media. You know, businesses
Yep.
that he supports, and all of them are of a single mind when it comes to reporting directly and accurately the words that come from this man's mouth when he is off the script, when he is actually answering a question that's not been rehearsed between he and his handlers. And this is devastating, but it is also so instructive and so much of a window into what's going on in between those gubernatorial ears.
And, you know, I look at his travel pattern. You know, there's, my first thought on it was, well, maybe if he spent more time in Harrisburg, he might actually know that the delivery guy or the person who sells flowers down on the corner or, you know, the people who work in this city, the large number of Hispanics that live in this area. But, you know, you figure he's been on those junkets to Germany and to France and to
Brazil.
And, you know, you not to mention D.C. and Vegas and, North Carolina, I guess, for a while. He's done a lot of jet setting.
Well, yes, but intriguingly enough, you mentioned something. A couple of days ago, one of my coworkers was out in downtown Harrisburg, walking around the corner back to work after going out to grab a sandwich for lunch. And she saw the governor's limousine. He has this big GM SUV, Yukon Denali or something, with blacked-out windows, stopped on the corner of 3rd and Locust Streets in downtown Harrisburg. And the governor was sending out one of his minions, one of the people that we pay for to protect and guard him, one of our good, loyal state police officers who happens to be assigned to the governor's detail, jumping out to buy some flowers with the governor. Apparently the governor was taking home some flowers. And he did get out on the street long enough to see that vendor, and then, of course, leapt right back into his chauffeur-driven, taxpayer-expense, gas-guzzling SUV to shoot back up to the governor's mansion that we taxpayers pay for and sneak in apparently behind the gates to give Mrs. Corbett a handful of flowers that he bought for those few moments that he was actually on the street with the people, leaving his regal perch for a few moments for the purpose of snagging some flowers on a street corner.
Now, we all need to do that, and I don't know that I blame him for the flowers. I
don't blame him for the flowers. I blame him for the arrogance.
There you go. But, you know, you want to talk about arrogance, and this is something else I wanted to talk to you about, because, you know, one of the things that I found really disgusting over the weekend, because it was graduation weekend across the Commonwealth and really across the country, our governor was asked and gave the commencement speech at Millersville University. And here on the program, we've had a couple of students who were Millersville grads who were really very angry about it, considering the fact that in this guy's first two budgets, he wanted to cut 50% from one budget to higher ed and 30% from another budget to higher ed, and have made these kids' lives much more difficult and made it much more difficult for them to graduate. And they, and I agree, thought it was just kind of a slap in the face.
Well, it is a slap in the face, but it's much beyond a slap in the face. Once again, we need to deal with and parse these kinds of things, because it's not a gaffe. It's not the next sensational headline about what words came out of this guy's mouth. This is about the substance of the man. This is about his backbone, his core, his moral compass. And what he has done, Millersville is just an extraordinarily wise and demonstrative example. Millersville University is part of the state system of higher education. 13 universities spread across the state that are the people's colleges. These are the universities, the schools at which working people's children can get an education. They're not the hoity-toity MITs and Harvards, Yales and Princeton's, Browns, Columbias. They are the people schools. And he has looked all of us in the eye and said, you know what? We're going to slash and burn the budgets of the people schools because, in the end, not everybody really deserves a college education. And if we look at what he said as those courageous students turned their chairs around and turned their backs on him as he made a commencement speech at a public university that he has defunded, one of the things he spoke of, one of the little vignettes, was he gave an example of the future for these newly graduated students. And the example he gave was about Thomas Edison, famous American inventor. He brought to us things like the light bulb and the phonograph. And Governor Corbett announced that Thomas Edison lost a fortune trying to develop coal before he hit the home runs with things like the light bulb and the phonograph. And Corbett, in reporting this to the students as somehow an example of what they should look forward to and strive toward, told the assembled graduates and their families that Edison lost a fortune in trying to develop coal, but of course it was his own money. It's not like what the rest of the people around here now need a lesson for in Harrisburg when they use and spend other people's money.
Yep.
Now, he doesn't get it.
Yeah,
and the real problem with Tom Corbett is not Democrat or Republican, conservative or liberal. It is that this guy is out of touch and out of whack.
Yeah, I thought it was interesting he told that story, especially talking about other people's money that he was taking out of education. All those kids that sat there, that's their money that he took away. That's their future, their education.
Well, and that's the key. He has not mortgaged their futures and their education. He has stripped them of it. And he's stripping our public primary and secondary schools of it. And then he has the colossal gall at the same time to suggest yet one more tax break for his corporate buddies, most of whom would agree that they don't pay their fair share in taxes.
Yeah.
I mean, it's not the Apple example where Apple's CEO testified to the Congress of the United States yesterday that they're not breaking any laws. Corbett is in the business of creating new laws to create yet new tax breaks for his corporate buddies when so many already exist. And he does it all at the expense of things like access to health care, education funding. And then he does the most cynical kinds of things at all, creating new means tests for people who are eligible for food stamps, even though the funding for food stamps does not even come out of state budgets.
Yeah, well, it's this mentality of punishing people. Punishing people for being poor.
Well, it's a mentality of using the people's government, to punish them for having been poor, for having not had the same access to privilege and power that Tom Corbett and his family have.
So let me ask you, last question I've got for you. You know, in looking at his speech, he left the graduating class who busted their behinds for several years to earn this degree. He left them with basically a greeting card slogan, which was live life, laugh often, and love much. And I'm going to, that's the message, that's the inspiration from our governor, a greeting card slogan?
Well, it may be the best a guy like him can muster, because as I say, I don't find these statements to be gaffes. I find them to be insights.
That's who he is.
And in the end, what I have is Governor Soundbite, Governor Colloquialism, Governor Greeting Card Statement Message. And it shocks the conscience that here we are in a time when Pennsylvania's unemployment rate continues to exceed the national average, even after they passed laws last year to take people out of the method by which we count unemployment. Even as we are losing 25,000 here and 50,000 there, members of the labor force, even as in order to pump up the employment marketplace figures, they count everybody in the military as being employed so that they can make it appear as if the numbers are better and we're still below the national average here in Pennsylvania. Even though when Corbett took over as governor, we were below the national average in unemployment here in Pennsylvania. This guy is worried about soundbite greetings to college graduates after he kicks them in the pants, steals their money, increases their tuition, attempts to slash the pay of their professors who are working diligently to help these kids get an education in the future, and then suggests that the real example here is not them because they apparently use other people's money to advance their cause, but Thomas Alva Edison, who lost his own personal fortune and therefore was a good guy.
There you go. Amazing stuff. As campaign season warms up, I cannot wait to hear more into the mind of Tom Corbett. Irwin, it's always great talking with you. I appreciate the time.
Good to be here. Thanks. Hopefully I get to talk to you again next week, and hopefully we'll have some good news to report.
Good news. Congratulations on the announcement of you being a future grandfather.
Well, thank you. What a wonderful wish. Thanks so much. We're very excited about it, and our little girl who was the original union bug, her birth announcements were a union bug with a baby's footprint in it, is now making her own and having her own, and we couldn't be any more excited, and thanks for that good wish.
Good for you and good for her as well. Thanks so much, Irwin.
Thank you.
Quick break, right back. 1-888-520-RICK, 1-888-520-7425. This is the Rick Smith Show. We're working people on the talk.
In an ocean of red, Rick Smith.
You're listening to the best of the Rick Smith Show. Enjoy your holiday. AFSCME Council 13 members, did you know that you have voluntary benefits available to you that you can pay for through the ease of payroll deduction? AFSCME Council 13 offers a voluntary benefits package to help provide money when you or a covered family member incurs one of these life events, accidents, critical illness, disability, or death. No one can avoid life's unfortunate situations. However, AFSCME Council 13 has provided you with the opportunity to ease the financial burden on your family by preparing now. Find out more about Trustmark's voluntary benefits. BBS Benefit Solutions can help you get the security you need. Call BBS at 1-866-902-2561. Again, call BBS at 1-866-902-2561.
Whenever one of our cities gets a star turn as host of some super sparkly event, such as a national political gathering or a Super Bowl, its first move is to tidy up by having the police sweep homeless people into jail, out of town, or under some rug. But the tidy uppers of Houston, Texas, aren't waiting for a world-class event to rationalize going after homeless down-and-outers. They've preemptively outlawed the crime of dumpster diving. In March, James Kelly, a 44-year-old Navy veteran, was passing through Houston on his way to connect with family in California. Homeless, destitute, and hungry, he chose to check out the dining delicacies in a trash bin near City Hall. Spotted by police, Kelly was promptly charged with, quote, disturbing the contents of a garbage can in the Central Business District. Seriously, I was just basically looking for something to eat, he told the Houston Chronicle. But unbeknownst to both this indigent tourist and the great majority of Houston's generally generous citizens, an ordinance dating way back to 1942 says that, quote, molesting garbage containers is illegal. Also, in 2012, city officials made it a crime for any group to hand out food to the needy in the downtown area without first getting a permit. It's a cold use of legal authority to chase the homeless away to, well, anywhere else. Such laws are part of an effort throughout the country to criminalize what some call homeless behavior. And sure enough, when hungry, the behavioral tendency of a homeless human is to seek a bite of nourishment, often in such dining spots as dumpsters. The homeless behavior that Houston has outlawed then is eating. This is Jim Hightower saying, when Houstonians learned of Kelly's rude experience, many reached out to help him get through his hard times. Now they need to reach out to local politicos and get the city's hard treatment of homeless people changed.
To get more of Jim Hightower's populist take on what Wall Street and Washington are up to, visit www.hightowerlowdown.org.
Hey there, fellow working class heroes. I have some great news. You can now get the Rick Smith Show podcast on your iPhone, Android, BlackBerry, or Palm on demand and on the go. Get your class war to go by downloading the Stitcher app on your smartphone by going to Stitcher.com and search for The Rick Smith Show, or go to our website at TheRickSmithShow.com and click on our Stitcher button. Together we can and we will rebuild a prosperous working class and leave opportunity for our children.
Sanity for a change. The Rick Smith Show.
Rick. 1-888-520-7425. Check out the website, TheRickSmithShow.com. So Representative Mark Amati, the representative from Nevada, he was walking down the street in D.C., and you know, somebody asked him, hey, are you willing to give up your congressional health care after you vote to repeal the Affordable Care Act? And he said he would be happy to. Happy to.
So did he?
No. Come on.
There have been state legislators who have given up their health care.
And, you know, but here's the thing.
You know, like libertarian leaning, and more power to them. If that's the way they feel and they're willing to put their own family at risk, fine.
But here's the thing. I mean,
but if they're only willing to put your family at risk?
You're talking about these kind of ideologues who have the resource to go out and buy in the private market. They have the ability to spend whatever. I look at Limbaugh saying, if you don't need health insurance, a guy who can write a check for anything that's going to happen to him. And I'm sure he has a catastrophic plan to where even if something really bad happened, it still wouldn't cost him much.
You know what? Somebody probably, Payola Plugola is his. He's probably violating FCC regulations as we speak to get somebody to give him, some insurance companies like got it down on the down low so that he pumps him up twice a week.
You know, but I look at the Millionaires Club that is our Congress, and, you know, the reality is, yeah, they can take a stand and say, yeah, see, I turned it down, because they've got the resources to be able to go and buy it somewhere else. The average American family, not so much. And I look at this story that came out earlier this afternoon that it just completely stopped me in my tracks. This idea that right now health care costs have exceeded the cost of feeding your family.
Mm. Oh, yeah.
I mean, stop and think about this for a minute. The security of knowing that if I get sick, I'm going to get care, and I may not. It's not that I'm not going to, but I may not go bankrupt. I may not lose everything I've ever worked for by having this illness. Is now costing more than it costs to feed my family? Are you kidding me? And you've got these conservatives that, nope, we need to go back to the way things were. Pay or die.
Preferably die.
Well,
I really think they feel that way. The people who can't afford to pay, those are the people they don't want around anyway. Somebody actually posted on one of our posts on Facebook about the Bangladesh thing. Someone actually said this. Come on, they're Muslims.
Are they?
Bangladesh is
mostly
a Muslim country, yeah.
But
that someone typed that into a link or typed it into a field and hit post. The black-heartedness of racism and classism and the war on poverty, which is really just the war on the poor, all that stuff, that black-heartedness is so pervasive that people aren't even ashamed of it.
Wow. And, you know, you look at that, and it's one of those things that just kind of grabs you because, you know, as we were talking to people today, this idea, and it's something that, you know, we haven't really talked about as a society, this idea that an injury to one person is an injury to all of us. And, you know,
that's because people don't believe that.
Once I started saying, look, you know, and I would ask people, what do you think would happen if we,
didn't get upset by this? What if you just think what happened if we allowed it to happen in places like Bangladesh and places like China and Vietnam and Sri Lanka and, you know, all these other places where we have these sweatshops? What do you think if we just said that was okay? What do you think would happen? And almost to a person, they all came back and said, eventually, and very commonsensically said, eventually, it comes here. And I hesitated for a minute because I didn't really want to get into the long conversation. Was, what do you mean eventually? Working conditions in this country, not as great as we think, when you've got, what, almost 5,000 people died last year on the job? 50,000 to 60,000 people every year die of occupational illness? It's happening. It's just that we're not hearing it. It's not to the scale of 1,127. It's not 100. But you know what? We're getting there.
Eight children died because a city wouldn't allow the school to have tornado shelters. So eight children died. But we are letting it happen. No CEOs of the companies that had the stuff made there are being brought up on charges. They're not going to be hauled into The Hague. We are letting it happen. If somebody went into another country and killed 1,127 people, they'd be called a terrorist. They'd be called a foreign terrorist. And if it was somebody that was a different religion, and I'm willing to bet that the CEO of Target, Macy's, JCPenney, Sears, Kohl's, blah, 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 keep going. I bet they're a different religion from Muslim, right? Oh, thank you.
All they care about is mine. I don't think they...
That's
religion doesn't play
in. No, but you know what? The people who have a different religion that do bad things here, they don't care about their religion either. I mean, it's never been about religion.
Right.
So, if somebody from another religion came into our country and killed 1,127 people, terrorism. But our country goes into Bangladesh, 1,127 people die, and I'll tell you what, nobody's coming up on charges. 4,000 more people will go into the next shack they have for making your Wrangler jeans, and they'll hope they live through their job because they're the only sustenance for their whole family.
And the thing that I ask, and I've wondered this a number of times, what happens to the people in those countries who are maimed? You know, 1,127 people died.
In the case of Bangladesh, the president of Bangladesh or the prime minister or whatever he is has said people will get prosthetic devices. They're going to
pony
up
give
the pay.
A 2x4.
Yeah.
So we're going to give a 2x4, and they could lean on that. But how are they going to support their families? These countries don't have workers' compensation.
Better they should die and decrease the surplus population.
Well, that's the billionaire view. I get that. But, you know, the sad reality is I'm part of, you're part of, Brett, my producer, he's part of. People listening, we're part of that surplus population.
Absolutely.
And that's the thing that got my attention in talking to people today. And that's why I love going out in the street and talking to people, because you connect and you understand that, you know what, we're all in this together. We may be a little bit up from the bottom, but not very far.
And wasn't it cool, the number of people who were, like, thanking us for telling them?
Yeah. I mean, the one guy basically tripped over himself to thank
you. To come back, yeah. Then there was another person, a woman who came out, and I got her on the way out of Target, and I handed her the paper, and she said, "Oh, my God, I'm so grateful I didn't buy any clothing. I was looking at pajamas." Did you hear her saying that?
Yeah, she did.
"I was looking at pajamas. I'm so grateful I didn't buy any clothing." She said, "And I'm never going back in there, not until this changes." She said, "I've got what I've got." It would have been great if she'd gone in and returned it.
Yeah.
That would have been priceless. But anyway, she said, "I've got this stuff." And it was kitchen stuff, like a dish drainer and that stuff. She said, "But I am not going back until this changes." And to hear people that all they need to know is the truth, and, oh, by the way, that's why they don't tell you the truth. That's why faux news is not telling you the truth, because you'll do something about it. Oregon police could not rescue a woman from rape because of budget cuts. This is the surplus population. Budget cuts have a tragic consequence in the state of Oregon when a woman stayed online with 911 for more than 10 minutes while her ex-boyfriend, who she had a restraining order against, broke into the house and raped her. Dispatch had it all on tape. But they didn't have enough sheriffs to dispatch someone to her house.
If she'd had a gun.
Yeah. If she'd had a gun, he could have taken it out of her hand and shot her with it.
Yeah.
The other thing I think that's important, though, is it's not just about this horrible rape and this terrible thing that happened to this woman. That sheriff that used to have that job is out of work.
Yep. But the screwquester's working. if doing
screw was the operative term, it is
point.
Working.
Quick break, right back. 1-888-520-RICK. 1-888-520-7425. Check out the website, therickssmithshow.com. Hey there, you're listening to the best of the Rick Smith Show. Enjoy your holiday.
It was 75 years ago that Capital Blue Cross officially opened for business. From our earliest days, serving our customers has been at the heart of everything we do. Together we've lived history and made history. And we're here to help guide you as we navigate a new era in healthcare together. Explore affordable health insurance options and use our free online tools to search for a provider, look up treatment costs, and more. All at capbluecross.com. Capital Blue Cross, celebrating 75 years of service. Capital Blue Cross is an independent licensee of the Blue Cross Blue Shield Association.
Hey there, fellow working class heroes. I have some great news. You can now get the Rick Smith Show podcast on your iPhone, Android, BlackBerry, or Palm on demand and on the go. Get your class war to go by downloading the Stitcher app on your smartphone by going to Stitcher.com and search for the Rick Smith Show, or go to our website at therickssmithshow.com and click on our Stitcher button. Together we can, and we will, rebuild a prosperous working class and leave opportunity for our children.
Earth. Sky.
Scientists have been able to store and successfully recall data from a strand of synthetic DNA.
They stored an audio recording of Martin Luther King Jr.'s I Have a Dream speech, plus Shakespeare's sonnets and more. They were able to translate, store, and retrieve this data. These scientists say it might be possible to store a billion books worth of data for thousands of years in a single small test tube. They published this result in the journal Nature in early 2013.
Storing information is what DNA does best. DNA holds our genetic code and spells out the exact genetic instructions required to create a particular organism. The researchers at the European Bioinformatics Institute commented that scientists now know how to extract DNA from bones of woolly mammoths. That DNA dates back tens of thousands of years, but still, they can make sense of it. They mentioned that DNA is incredibly small, dense, and doesn't need any power for storage.
Previous attempts at encoding data onto DNA failed because those methods tried to translate a computer's binary data directly onto the DNA. They said binary repetition caused errors in retrieval.
This time, they succeeded by translating the binary information into ternary information. In other words, it uses 0, 1, and 2, and then encoding that into the DNA. We have more on this story at earthsky.org. Search for DNA. I'm Michael Brennan.
And I'm Emily Howard. Earth Sky is a clear voice for science. We're at earthsky.org.
Where family values are more than slogans. The Rick Smith Show.
Welcome back to the Rick Smith Show. Check out the website, therickssmithshow.com. Questions, comments, something on your mind, you can email me, rick@therickssmithshow.com. If you missed any portion of our program, you can download it there at the website, or you can get the podcast there at Stitcher on your smartphone. Also, you can like us on Facebook, follow us on Twitter, all of that stuff all the time. You know, as I pointed out in the last segment, you know, you got this congressman who's saying, well, yeah, I'll give up my health care. Be happy to do it. Happy to do it. When you've got, what, some 50 million people uninsured, those folks not happy. And what I found really interesting, I saw this survey, this poll that just came out from the Joint Center, who have you know, basically gone into the deep South, Alabama, Georgia, Louisiana, Mississippi, South Carolina, and have gone, hey, you know, what do you think about expanding Medicare and expanding Medicaid so that you guys could get some healthcare? What do you think about that? Overall, more than 60% of the people living in those states said, I think it's a good idea that we actually get some coverage. Alabama, 64% of the people in Alabama were in favor of it. South Carolina, 65% of the people in favor of it. And I found it extremely interesting that you break it down by political view. The liberals, 78% said, yeah, we need to do this. Moderates, 69.3%. And it's the conservatives. And I would argue that these are the people who already have health care, but the costs are going to go out of control where they're not even going to have it soon. 46, almost 47%. And you break it down by age, the younger generation gets it. Because you know why? They're the ones, Pat, they're the ones that are uninsured. Mm-hmm. The 18 to 24 rate, they're uninsured. And more than two-thirds said, you know what, we need the Medicaid expansion. Because you know what, we'd like to be covered, thank you very much. And that's the age group that's thankful to the Affordable Care Act, because if their parents have it, guess what? They get to stay on it as well. What I found interesting from the poll, though, is that once you got to the senior citizens, those 65 and above, they were the least favorable of expanding Medicaid. Just 60% of those folks.
Still 60%.
Yeah, still 60%, but not the 66% of the younger generation. And, you know, I look at this and you go through these states. You go through the Alabamas and the Georgias and the Louisianas and the Mississippis and the South Carolina, these deep South states. All of their governors, like Tom Corbett, not taking the Medicaid expansion money. And you've got to wonder what it is about these people in these states that continue to elect these kind of people, who clearly the folks in these communities want it. They see that it's going to make their lives better, but you've got these handful, well, these handful of governors saying, no, we're not doing it.
I was looking at a statistic the other day that eight, Pennsylvania Commonwealth senators, Republican senators, ran unopposed.
Yeah.
There comes a point where people get elected because there's nobody up against them. And for anybody who doesn't like Obama, for any Republican who doesn't think President Obama is a suitable president, Mitt Romney.
God. God, be nice.
Nobody made President Obama president faster than the Republican Party.
That's true, because he had no business winning.
No, and Mitt Romney had no business running. Neither did
but Snow White
Michelle
and the rest
Bachmann,
of the seven dwarfs.
Right. Neither did, what's his name, Pizza Boy. None of them. None of them had any business running.
Newt, you didn't like Newt?
Holy mother of God, Newt Gingrich hasn't got an ethical bone. Well, he hasn't got any bones, I don't think. I think he's sort of doughy. You know, he's a bit doughy. But
how about
there is nobody up against some of these people, or the people are so insane. And then when anybody runs in a third party, people say, oh, I'd love to vote for you, but you just can't win. You know why I can't win? Because you're an idiot. Because if you would vote for somebody who actually loves you or cares about you or gives a damn if your kid is fed, you'd have a whole different paradigm, you know? But
you look at yesterday.
I got to tell you, that's why these people win. People liked George Bush's swagger.
Yeah, you look at yesterday, because we'd like to have a beer with him. But you look at yesterday, what was it? 14% of the people showed up to vote? 14%. Quick break, right back with Hour 2. Stick around. You're listening to The Rick Smith Show. We're working people. Come to talk.
Smith Show, changing America for the better.
You're listening to the best of the Rick Smith Show. Enjoy your holiday.
It's the Rick Smith Show on Country Gold Radio, WIOO Carlisle, and WEEO Shippensburg.
You're listening to WIN, Workers Independent News, a production of Diversified Media Enterprises. I'm Doug Cunningham. AFSCME Medical Center workers in California began a two-day strike Tuesday, Jesse Russell reports.
All five University of California Medical Centers saw picket lines on Tuesday as workers walked off the job over stalled contract negotiations. It was the first day of a planned two-day strike brought on by employees demanding a contract that includes fair wages and an increased commitment to patient safety. Margaret Mann is a hospital lab tech at UC San Francisco's Medical Center.
since, I think, last June. We've been working without a contract, and the university is, they're just not paying attention to any of our concerns at all.
Representatives of the UC system have criticized the strike action as putting patients in the middle of a labor dispute, but Mann said they took the action as a last resort.
You know, as far as the patients in there today, we have to deal with them 365 days a year. You know, we care about them 365 days a year. And if this is the only way we can make things better, and this is the action of last resort, we have tried everything. Nobody wanted to do this.
The workers are represented by the American Federation of State, County, and Municipal Employees, Local 3299. But they weren't the only workers on the strike lines. The University Professional and Technical Workers, Local 9119, launched a sympathy strike and marched along with their co-workers. UPT workers said they shared the same concerns regarding rising executive salaries, while workers are asked to accept concessions to patient care.
In Washington, D.C., federal workers protesting low wages walked off their jobs at several federal buildings. The workers have organized as Good Jobs Nation. They work for federal contractors at the Ronald Reagan Building, the Smithsonian, Union Station, and other buildings. The federal government is the largest employer of low-wage workers in America, with some 2 million low-wage workers working for the government through contractors paid for by tax money. Those workers want a real living wage. Low-wage workers are rising up, fighting for living wages and union organizing rights all over America, from New York City to Walmart warehouses in California and Chicago to Detroit, St. Louis, and Milwaukee, to name just a few. Jennifer Epps Addison is with the Milwaukee Workers Organizing Committee.
It really just comes from everyday working people who are doing everything they can and doing everything right, doing exactly what they were told they're supposed to do, and yet at the end of the week or at the end of the month, don't have enough to meet their basic needs. They can't keep their rent paid. They can't keep their lights on. And most importantly, they can't take care of their children. And so folks really came together and they started talking about their conditions. We were inspired by what's happening across the country. And so we decided that we needed to turn those poverty wage jobs into good jobs, into jobs that could support a family.
Workers Independent News is made possible in part through underwriting support from the International Brotherhood of Teamsters. You've been listening to WIN, Workers Independent News. For more information, visit laborradio.org.
Time for change. It's time to rearrange.
Keeping the Chambers of Commerce within their gated communities. The Rick Smith Show.
You can't tell me we're gonna make somehow. I heard a wise man say revolution starts now. I think it's time for change.
Welcome back to the Rick Smith Show. Check out the website, thericksmithshow.com. Well, that changed. That's why we were out in the streets today talking to people in front of Macy's and Target and of course, the JCPenney's, saying, you know, hey, look, you know, we need to be holding these companies accountable. I don't want to feel guilty about buying products if they were made with child labor, or if, you know, heaven forbid, you know, somebody went to work and the building collapses on them because there's no safety regulations. I got a serious problem. And you know what? You know what? What I found as we talked to people all day, they don't want it either. And I was so surprised about 90% of the people we talked to had not heard that this tragedy happened. And I think that's a failure of the mainstream corporate-controlled media. My next guest is one of the guys who, I'm saying, one of the good guys here. In fact, he is the recipient, the winner of May's Sidney Hillman Foundation Award for journalists who do investigative reporting and deep storytelling. And on this Bangladesh issue, this guy's been right there the entire time. Stephen Greenhouse, thanks for taking time for me.
Nice to be here, Rick.
And congratulations on the award to start off.
Thanks very much. And I've been working closely with our two fabulous reporters in Bangladesh, Jim Yardley and Yusufkar Malin.
What do you say to the fact that, you know, the vast majority of the people we talked to today never heard of it?
It's sad. You know, we Americans, you know, in fourth grade or seventh grade, we all learned about the horrific Triangle Shirtwaist Fire in 1911, which was, the worst, arguably the worst factory industrial tragedy in American history. 146 workers died. We all learned about that, and that really changed America. And here at this factory in faraway Bangladesh, you know, and Bangladesh makes clothes for lots of Americans, many Americans probably wearing a T-shirt or jeans worn in Bangladesh. There was a horrible, horrible factory collapse a month ago where 1,127 workers died. That's an unimaginable number. You know, one third the number of people who died in 9/11, seven times the number who died in the Triangle Fire. It was horrible. And now the question is, will, you know, Western retailers, European retailers, and American retailers really step up, Rick, to do what's needed to ensure factory safety in Bangladesh, to ensure that nothing like this ever happens again.
And that's what we were talking to people on the street about. And what I found very interesting is people kept asking the question, well, what should our government doing? And I say, nothing. You and me, we should be telling these companies, we don't want you doing business with companies that are going to have their workers come to an eight-story building and have the building collapse on them, because people knew the foundation was faulty and they knew that this was possible.
Right. I speak to some union leaders, you know, some union leaders even in Europe who have really been very instrumental in pushing various retailers to step up and get involved and promise to help pay for needed factory safety in Bangladesh. And some of these people say, where is President Obama? Why isn't he, you know, pressing American retailers to do more? And, you know, Bangladesh is a very poor country. One of the reasons so many American retailers are happy to give tons of orders to Bangladesh because it has the world's lowest minimum wage, just $37 a month, which is an amazingly low number. You have all these workers, Rick, working like 200 hours a month and getting paid, you know, $37 for the month. It's just mind-boggling to believe. And the factory owners say that, you know, the American companies, Target, Gap, Walmart, Penny, Sears, are not willing to pay high enough prices for the T-shirts and jeans they manufacture to enable the factories to invest in fire escapes, invest in fireproof, smoke-proof staircases that would be needed to prevent more people dying in the next fire.
You know, what I found very interesting as I was talking to people today, I said, you know, the reality is, you know, we keep hearing about we need to have more competition here in the U.S. and we need more deregulation. And I say at the end of it, this mantra of more competition, more deregulation gets us to be Bangladesh. Because to me, that's what no regulation looks like. And we've talked to a couple of people from Bangladesh since this has happened. And they say, well, they have regulation, but no one to enforce them. The more I look at what's going on in our country as we've neutered and gutted our regulatory oversight, I wonder, you know, down the road, you know, are we setting ourselves up to be similar?
Well, we saw this terrible factory explosion, not factory explosion.
In West Texas.
Fertilizer plant explosion in Texas, and many people say that resulted from a lack of regulation. And as you and your listeners know, Rick, there's a lot of tension in the United States with some people saying we need more regulation. You know, labor unions generally, Democrats and many Republicans saying we have too much regulation. It's discouraging businesses from expanding and creating jobs. But, you know, we've just been through a period of declining regulation, which many economists say helped lead to the recession with, you know, the foreclosure crisis. And anyway, in Bangladesh, I think everyone agrees that there isn't much regulation by the government because the government doesn't want to crack down too hard on factory safety or wage violations because it worries that if it does, you know, the Walmarts, the Sears, the Gaps, the Targets, the children's places will say, well, maybe we shouldn't send orders to this country. There's too much regulation or they're trying too hard to enforce, you know, minimum wage laws. So I think there's an incentive in a certain sense for the government of Bangladesh or Cambodia, Vietnam, all these kind of low-wage countries to compete with each other and not to regulate sufficiently. And Bangladesh is kind of at the bottom of the low road, and I think the pressures there are greatest not to regulate. Plus you have this problem of many, you know, building inspectors, government inspectors are not paid very much,
right,
and they're taking money under the
sure.
table.
Absolutely.
They're taking bribes not to enforce, not to inspect properly, and that's a real problem. And one of the most interesting things here is, so this landmark safety plan has been developed in which 36 retailers have pledged to help finance probably millions, maybe even hundreds of millions of dollars worth of factory improvements, safety improvements to stop future collapses and stop future factory fires and deaths. And basically, you know, 36 European companies have signed up and just 2 American companies signed up. And I asked the European retailers, why did you sign up? And they say, you know, for years we've all had our individual inspection plans. We've all been doing it alone, and we're all kind of undercutting each other. We all don't want to spend too much on inspections or improving factory safety because that might raise our prices. And they kind of say the only way to fix things is by a cooperative group plan where we all work together and try not to undercut each other to, have good, strong factory inspections, to promise to, stop doing business at factories that have lots of violations, to work together to figure out ways to finance the needed improvements. And, very interestingly, the American retailers generally shun this plan, and they, much more than the Europeans, still stick to a go-it-alone, do-it-ourselves approach.
To where we can possibly undercut each other and slit each other's throats. Because to me, it sounds what you laid out is what I think the competition that I would want to compete on a level playing field where everyone has the same rules, much like when I played football or any other sport. There were rules. We all played by it. And that was how it was. And no one got to cheat.
It's almost like there's some libertarians who say we shouldn't have a minimum wage. It should be every business should be able to do what it wants to do, and who cares if some workers are paid only 35 cents an hour? And others say, wait a second, businesses will forever undercut each other. Workers, desperate workers might be willing to work for a dollar or two an hour, and they're saying the decent thing to do, the right thing to do, is to set a floor so that no one works for less than $7.25 an hour, and that. Wages might go up to $9 or $10 an hour, and I think the Europeans are saying maybe we'll try to outcompete each other on style or somewhat on price. But there's one thing where we will no longer agree to try to undercut each other, and that's on very basics like factory safety, because there has been a mind-boggling, shocking series of factory disasters in Asia over the past year, all at factories that mainly produced for Western companies. In addition to this horrible factory collapse on April 24th, where more than 1,000 people died, there was a horrible factory fire in November in Bangladesh, where 112 workers died. And then in Pakistan in September, there was another horrific factory fire where 262 people died. And my investigation of that fire, along with our reporters in Asia, we found that six different contractors for Walmart, had used the factory, the factory in Pakistan, and the factory in Bangladesh that burned, the Tazreen factory, right. in November. So there are a lot of pressures, an increasing amount of pressures on the American companies to really step up and contribute to and join this plan to help finance factory safety. But the Americans say, if we join that plan, we worry about legal liability. We worry that we're going to get sued. And many critics, and I write about this in my story in tomorrow's New York Times, many critics say the American fears of lawsuits and legal liability are totally exaggerated, totally overblown.
But even if you say that there are lawsuits and that potential is there, isn't that the way we hold these people accountable when they're supposed to be policing themselves?
Rick, in a certain way, yes. But the Americans, American companies hate litigiousness, they hate lawsuits, and in ways, the big issue now is whether the retailers of the world, the deep-pocketed retailers who can afford to help finance the needed factory safety improvements in Bangladesh, whether that will come together. And the Americans say, well, we're scared of joining this binding, legally enforceable plan because it might lead to lawsuits and liability, and in the negotiations that the American retailers have had with the labor unions and European retailers who are behind the plan, the Americans keep saying, we're worried about lawsuits, we're worried about lawsuits. And I think to get the Americans on board, either something has to be done to allay their concerns about lawsuits, or something has to be done to persuade them that their fears of lawsuits are just plain unfounded.
What about the 1,127 people who were killed in this tragedy that I believe could have been avoided had you had safety regulations in place? What about those? Are there going to be any losses out of this? And what about the people who are in charge of this? Are any criminal charges? Are we going to be putting anybody in prison over this? Or are they going,
this factory collapse risk is kind of a perfect storm. We had the person who owns the building, was a total, he was very well plugged in politically. His father was a big deal politically, and he added three extra floors onto this building without having the proper permits, and basically the building just couldn't support it. So He's been indicted, and they're seeking the death sentence against him. And then there are five factories in the building that collapsed. And the day before the building collapsed, people saw cracks in the walls and in the pillars. And that afternoon, many fled the building, saying this is too dangerous. Yet the next morning, the factory owners told hundreds of workers, you have to go back to work. We're going to miss our production deadlines. And the workers didn't want to go back, but they were told they might be fired or they'd lose months and months of pay unless they went back. And they went back, and the building collapsed at 9 in the morning, and, 1,127 people died. And now the Bangladesh officials released an investigative report about the factory collapse today, and they're calling for homicide indictments against the five factory owners.
And I think it's probably not a bad idea. Maybe some of the CEOs we go after who keep pushing for this, because to me this is all indicative of this push for the race to the bottom, and I think someone has to be held accountable, if not through lawsuits, through something.
Well, the folks who are saying the retailers have to, should do more, should step up and do more, some labor advocates, work advocates I speak with say, they're dismayed that the retailers aren't moving faster, and they're concerned that American consumers just are not very concerned about all this. And it was enlightening to me, Rick, when you said you went out and interviewed all these shoppers, all these consumers, all these American members of the public, and 90% of them didn't know about it. And I wish that everyone could read the New York Times and be better informed, but that's probably a pipe dream. But I imagine, people who are watching get their news from TV often aren't going to hear much about these horrible things happening abroad, even when they're happening at the very factories that make the clothes that many Americans wear.
But I'll tell you, these people, they want to hear it. They want the folks that we ran into today and we talked to, they want this information. And it's just not, I don't see that it's readily available, which is why we asked you to come on the program and talk about this, because I think this is so vitally important.
Well, I'm happy to be on the show, and I think a lot of Americans, they want to do the right thing, and when they have the information they need, then they will often act on it.
So, last question I've got for you, in looking at this scenario, you personally, where do you fall with this? Will you be going into a place like Target? Will you be going into a place like this, given their history?
So I'm a reporter for an objective newspaper, and I can't say whether or not I want to boycott anything. People have asked me, what's the best way to voice concern? And I say, if you decide not to shop at Target, if you decide not to shop at Sears, if you decide not to shop at the Children's Place or Gap or Walmart, the companies are not going to really know unless, 100,000, 200,000, 300,000. And, I think the best way for people to make their concerns known is to write a letter, make a phone call, send an email, because that's the way to, to register objections.
Yeah, I'm of the mindset as well. Look, I would love to see 200,000-300,000 people say not until you do the right thing. That's just my view on it. But I appreciate the time, Stephen. It's always great talking with you. I appreciate it, and congratulations again on being the recipient of May's Sidney Hillman Foundation Award.
Thanks so much, and keep up the good work.
Thanks so much.
Sure.
Quick break. Right back. 1-888-520-RICK. 1-888-520-7425. This is the Rick Smith Show. We're working people. Come to talk.
Yes, it is all about the children, even after they're born. Rick Smith.
You're listening to the best of the Rick Smith Show. Enjoy your holiday.
Whenever one of our cities gets a star turn as host of some super sparkly event, such as a national political gathering or a Super Bowl, its first move is to tidy up by having the police sweep homeless people into jail, out of town, or under some rug. But the tidy uppers of Houston, Texas, aren't waiting for a world-class event to rationalize going after homeless down-and-outers. They preemptively outlawed the crime of dumpster diving. In March, James Kelly, a 44-year-old Navy veteran, was passing through Houston on his way to connect with family in California. Homeless, destitute, and hungry, he chose to check out the dining delicacies in a trash bin near City Hall. Spotted by police, Kelly was promptly charged with, quote, disturbing the contents of a garbage can in the Central Business District. Seriously, I was just basically looking for something to eat, he told the Houston Chronicle. But unbeknownst to both this indigent tourist and the great majority of Houston's generally generous citizens, an ordinance dating way back to 1942 says that, quote, molesting garbage containers is illegal. Also, in 2012, city officials made it a crime for any group to hand out food to the needy in the downtown area without first getting a permit. It's a cold use of legal authority to chase the homeless away to, well, anywhere else. Such laws are part of an effort throughout the country to criminalize what some call homeless behavior. And sure enough, when hungry, the behavioral tendency of a homeless human is to seek a bite of nourishment, often in such dining spots as dumpsters. The homeless behavior that Houston has outlawed then is eating. This is Jim Hightower saying, when Houstonians learned of Kelly's rude experience, many reached out to help him get through his hard times. Now they need to reach out to local politicos and get the city's hard treatment of homeless people changed.
To get more of Jim Hightower's populist take on what Wall Street and Washington are up to, visit www.hightowerlowdown.org.
At PSECU, we'd love to help you get the ride you're drawn to. Buy the car you truly want with a loan you can afford. Car, truck, minivan, SUV, scooter, or cycle, new or used, we have a solution for you. Get a rate as low as 1.49 annual percentage rate. Additional rates and terms are available. With PSECU, you can get the ride you truly want.
At PSECU, we've lowered our rates just in time for summer. Get the car you truly want with a 2.99 annual percentage rate. New, used, or simply refinance the car you already have. Choose a payment term of 6 or 7 years, which means more cash in your pocket now. Additional rates and terms are available. Financing life is what we do best. Talk with us. Call 800-LOAN-555 or visit pseCU.com/life today.
This credit union is federally insured by the National Credit Union Administration. Equal opportunity lender.
Check out the website, TheRickSmithShow.com. Questions, comments, something on your mind, you can email me, Rick@TheRickSmithShow.com, or give us a call, 1-888-520-RICK, 1-888-520-7425. Our quote of the day, Pat, our quote of the day. U.S. Secretary of Education, our good friend Arnie, Arnie Duncan said, Target has been a great supporter of our efforts to improve education.
Target.
Yep. They put the little cans out every once in a while, donate a couple bucks. Because, you know, hey, what's better for education than a corporation, you know, donating money that they get to write off of their taxes off of profits that they made exploiting people in places like Bangladesh? I mean, what could be better for education?
I found it absolutely fascinating. Brett, who is really shouldn't be behind the scenes because he's so smart, but he said if they put a can out and sold, like, dollar balloons for Bangladesh, Target could have the $500,000
in a snap
from the people.
Yep.
The people would do it. Hey, we've been making our stuff in sweatshops. And, oh, by the way, that double-knit polyester looks lovely on you. We know you want to continue buying that sort of lovely garment. Therefore...
And saving that 10 cents.
Yes. And, honest to God, the American flag looks great draped across your hindside. So... Or strange words that really I don't want to read. But if they put the can out, they'd have the money. And Target still won't put the $500,000 in.
And, you know, there was a woman you had said that to. She was $500,000? And because to me, $500,000 sounds like an awful lot of money. I don't have 500 grand. But to a corporation, a multinational, a massive corporation like Walmart, like Target, like Macy's,
JCPenney.
I mean, these massive behemoths. I mean, I'm sorry.
If you're so marginal that people have to die to make your crew socks, stop selling them.
But I need that penny. And here's the thing that Greenhouse said, and I think is extremely important, and something that I've talked about often on this program. And I was glad to hear a New York Times reporter get that there's got to be a floor that, you know, you have safety standards that we agree on, that, you know, when you go to work in the morning, you go home to your family at night, that, you know, the place where you work isn't going to kill you.
When he said that the guy put three floors on without asking anybody, and the people saw the cracks in the walls and they were so frightened they went home, these aren't people who were caught unaware. These are people who were forced to go back to work the next day after the day before they went home because they saw the cracks in the walls.
No, I mean, that's almost like walking, you know, that last mile on death row. You're dead man walking, because you knew when you walked in that building.
Well, it is fascinating that the owner of the factory faces the death penalty, but the companies that
paid
him...
They have to do that. All right, I got to be honest. I think the country would erupt if you didn't have this sacrificial lamb. To me, I think what's going to happen.
Oh, hang on. I want to see the guy from West Texas then. No, the country won't erupt. It won't. They get it. Somehow they actually understand that the owner of the company. I mean, look at what we do to people, day in and day out, and get away with it. The same thing with China. I think this is some sort of an Asian. I mean, they sentence CEOs to death over there. So I'm thinking.
I'm with you. I know where you're going with this.
I don't believe in the death penalty, but you could put the CEOs of every...
You can make an argument.
Well, you could lock them up and throw away the key. I tell you what, I'll trade
you...
Put
them in the factories that are crumbling. make them do that walk.
Make them do the work, yeah.
No, the walk. I just want them to walk into the building. You just sit there. And I've made this argument in the past, you know. To my friends who say union members make too much money, I said, you know, what would it cost? How much would it cost for you to come and just stand in my driveway in the middle of January? Just stand there. How much is it for you to do the work that has to be done? And going to conditions like that. I mean, would you get one of the CEOs who, on average this year, in 2012, averaged $9.7 million? This is now an all-time record for CEOs. As an average, $9.7 million per CEO. And the healthcare and media people, you know, the people who are diverting our attention and stealing our healthcare money, they were at the very top of that list.
Absolutely, because a conscience sells at a certain rate. When your conscience is just a few people dying and you can maybe wipe it off your brain because they were working in a factory and you weren't there at the time and you didn't know or some other stupid... that you can have a certain amount of denial for $9 million. When the denial is you know someone with cancer didn't get their medicine and you're in the healthcare one, that denial, that's a lot harder to come by. That's $15 million denial.
Yeah. And you look at the one CEO, the guy from Duke Energy. He made $44 million one day.
What?
One day. He worked one day. $44 million. One day.
He made more than every person in Bangladesh will make in their lifetimes in one day.
And you hear these people, well, you know, we're broke. We don't have money, Pat. How could we possibly have regulation? Because to me, this whole Bangladesh story is the cautionary tale. Look, you know, because I know people who say, why should we have building codes? I should be able to put an addition on my house without anybody coming out. Why do they get in my business? They put three floors onto a building that no way, it shouldn't even been five floors to begin with. They added three more on top of that.
I'm speechless, which is a bad thing for radio. It's remarkable, too, that people don't believe this about, first of all, people don't know it, so they can't believe it. And that really was the kicker of today. And I know we're wonks. I know we're not typical consumers. I know that I'm addicted to the news feed. When the New York Times reporter said, I wish everybody could read the New York Times, I was like, they don't?
Don't?
Are you kidding me? It's not on, like, speed dial for the
That's
web,
the liberal
the
review.
Webpage. Okay, then read a conservative rag, too. Read everything. I mean, get your news. I cannot believe that. Yeah. And so I understand it, but for
weed?
Literally almost every person we talked to not to know.
Yeah, it was literally stunning.
And then almost everyone we talked to once they chatted with us, anyone who stopped and chatted for more than 30 seconds was like, yeah, this is wrong. So if you just tell them, but that's the thing, that's like the 80% who want health care or the 90% who want background checks for guns or the this percent or the that percent. We don't have a representative democracy.
Right.
So I don't know why they're afraid of us knowing. They're not doing anything about it anyway.
That's why they're afraid. That's why they don't. That's why. I mean, that's why they don't want us knowing and they don't want us be participating. 17% of the people voted yesterday. 17%.
I think every single person
nuts.
Who runs one of these companies that refuses to be proponents of worker safety, every one of those CEOs should be brought up on charges.
I'm with you. Quick break. Right back. Going to answer the question, where should we shop? I heard that a lot today. If not here, where? Well, we'll talk to somebody who might help us answer that. Quick break. Right back.
Can make America better. The Rick Smith Show.
You're listening to the best of The Rick Smith Show. Enjoy your holiday.
It was 75 years ago that Capital Blue Cross officially opened for business. From our earliest days, serving our customers has been at the heart of everything we do. Together we've lived history and made history. And we're here to help guide you as we navigate a new era in healthcare together. Explore affordable health insurance options and use our free online tools to search for a provider, look up treatment costs, and more. All at capbluecross.com. Capital Blue Cross, celebrating 75 years of service. Capital Blue Cross is an independent licensee the Blue Cross Blue Shield Association.
Earth, sky.
Scientists have been able to store and successfully recall data from a strand of synthetic DNA.
They stored an audio recording of Martin Luther King Jr.'s I Have a Dream speech, plus Shakespeare's sonnets and more. They were able to translate, store, and retrieve this data. These scientists say it might be possible to store a billion books worth of data for thousands of years in a single small test tube. They published this result in the journal Nature in early 2013.
Storing information is what DNA does best. DNA holds our genetic code and spells out the exact genetic instructions required to create a particular organism. The researchers at the European Bioinformatics Institute commented that scientists now know how to extract DNA from bones of woolly mammoths. That DNA dates back tens of thousands of years, but still, they can make sense of it. They mentioned that DNA is incredibly small, dense, and doesn't need any power for storage.
Previous attempts at encoding data onto DNA failed because those methods tried to translate a computer's binary data directly onto the DNA. They said binary repetition caused errors in retrieval.
This time, they succeeded by translating the binary information into ternary information. In other words, it uses 0, 1, and 2, and then encoding that into the DNA. We have more on this story at earthsky.org. Search for DNA. I'm Michael Brennan.
And I'm Emily Howard. Earth Sky is a clear voice for science. We're at earthsky.org.
Waving the flag of freedom for people, not corporations. Rick Smith.
Check out the website, TheRickSmithShow.com. Of course, if it's comments, something on your mind, you can email me, Rick@TheRickSmithShow.com, or you can like us on Facebook, follow us on Twitter, all of that stuff. You know, today while we were out, the question kept popping up. Well, Rick, if we don't buy here, if we don't buy things from Bangladesh and Vietnam and China, where do we get things? You know, a lot of people want to buy American, don't know how, don't know where, because you know what? The Walmarts, the big chains, they're not stocking the shelves like they claim they are, which is why I've asked our friend Todd Litscombe. He is the head of MadeInUSAForever.com. Todd, thanks for taking time for me.
Rick, it's great to be back. I really enjoy doing your show.
I appreciate you being here. You know, I look at this, and you know, we were out in the streets today handing out flyers, informing people of this horrible tragedy in Bangladesh that claimed 1,127 lives. And, you know, you look at the companies, these 15 here in the U.S. Who haven't signed on to just the basic safety regulations, and it left people going, this is horrible. What do we do? And I keep saying, buy local, buy domestic, buy American.
Absolutely. You're not kidding. You know, when I worked in Asia for an American tech company, I saw a lot of things going on. If people really understood what was going on at the subcontractor level, they would understand these dangers are commonplace. This facility was just very dramatic and, of course, an incredibly terrible disaster. But it's going on all over Asia at a smaller scale, and, you know, it's just a human tragedy unfolding.
It absolutely is. And, you know, I look at this and, you know, again, we go back to what do we do? You know, and I noticed on your website you were talking about jeans. You know, to me, the icon of American culture, you know, my jeans are made in the U.S. I buy them online from a union place in Texas because I'm beyond buying American. I'm a big fan of buying union made products because I know that the workers are going to make a reasonable wage. They're going to have health care, some retirement security, and in decent conditions. And I think as consumers, we got to be thinking that way.
Absolutely. And you were right. I mean, these big retail chain stores, because of greed, they have hardly any American-made products on the shelf. These small suppliers, and there's over 600 of them now on my website, you know, can't even get on the shelves at these places. And it's just disgusting what they're doing to our nation. I mean, they're putting their own customers out of work in the long run just to get a bigger bonus this quarter. And I don't know where it's going to end, but it's not good. So we're doing all we can to challenge that. And there's other good websites, too, out there. I would encourage folks to go onto the net and look, because that's the real choice. Of course, if you can buy made in USA locally, I say go for it. But if you can't find what you're looking for, then, yeah, come and visit us and see. We've got a lot of cool stuff. We're always adding more. Yeah, Rick, if any of your listeners or future guests, you know, make stuff here in the States, they should contact me, definitely.
Yeah, I mean, you know, at the end of this, with the Internet, I mean, there's no reason not to be an informed consumer. And look, I understand, you know, we've been pushed into this, you know, the lowest price, because, you know, wages have been stagnant for so long.
Right.
But at the end of the day, I keep saying, you know, the reality is the job you may end up saving by buying something locally may be, well, your own.
Absolutely. Plus the value. I mean, we got to think about, you know, yes, the price may be more, but these big, you know, chain stores want us to, for example, buy a new snow shovel every year. You know, what happened to the ones that we'd buy once every 20 years? Well, they're still there, but they cost more up front. But in the long run, it ends up not only saving jobs, but also being a better value and cheaper in the long run.
And I guess the other part of this is we've got to watch out, you know, for the Made in the USA label, which you got to wonder. And on your website, you point out that Levi's said that they have a Made in the U.S. Pair of jeans that may
right.
not be.
Well, it's very ironic, isn't it, Rick? I mean, they had one pair on their website, Made in USA, they were claiming, and right in the description it said the fabric was made in China. So, I mean, that really upset me. But that, you know what happened today after we mentioned that? People got so upset and were calling them that they took it off the website.
See, and that's the power of so many people acting. You know, the one person I talked to said, well, you know, I'm just one person. What can I do? I go, yeah, but you're one person. That guy I talked to a minute ago, that's one person. And if they go home and they tell somebody, we begin to have a movement.
Absolutely.
And that's
like those grocery
mean.
Stores didn't want to put these organic products in their stores because it's trouble for them and it wasn't as profitable as the stuff they had going. But enough people bugged them. And now you see lots of organic products all over the place in these big stores. If we did this with Made in USA, you'd see whole sections of Made in USA products. You know, I really hope, Rick, that this movement gets big enough someday where I don't even need to do this on the website because it's taken off on its own locally in all these stores.
Yeah, I'm hoping that happens because I'm a big believer in domestic production, domestic consumption. You know, it's not that I don't want the people in Bangladesh to have jobs. I do. I want them
sure.
to be able to have jobs that they go, I make enough money that I can buy some of the things that I'm making.
Yeah, the Pope was right. I mean, it's like economic slavery over there. I mean, these people aren't making enough to feed themselves and they call it a job. You know, it's just ludicrous what they'll do to get to these Walmart low prices. You know, where you can find these American-made products. I mean, look at these jeans for $30, $35, American cotton, sewn here, the whole deal, versus those you know, Chinese fabric Levi's, they're trying to sell for $129.
That's what I was going to ask you. You know, is it, you said, we use the Walmart language. It's the low, low prices. Are they really that low? Because I got to be honest. I buy my American-made jeans, $35. About the same price you'd pay for something in Walmart somewhere else.
That is absolutely true. Plus, again, the quality issue. I mean, they have poor quality on purpose, this planned obsolescence, because they want people back in again and again, and the young people don't understand. They don't remember the good quality. They think, oh, well, you know, a piece of whatever for $9.95. They think they're getting a deal, and then 6 months later, they're buying another one. I mean,
Perfect example to that. Over the weekend, we had a birthday party for my daughter, and my wife's niece came over, and she was curling her hair with one of these cheap, you know, $9.99 hair curlers from Walmart, and the thing in her hand broke and burnt her shoulder to no end.
Oh my God, that's terrible! But they don't hold any responsibility. They don't feel a responsibility at all for stuff like that. It's ludicrous.
It's absolutely ludicrous, which is why I keep hoping, and I'm seeing it. The more you talk to people, the more you have these conversations, the more I think the light goes on, and that's why I always appreciate when you come and talk about your site and you come and talk about the work that you're doing, because I think it's important.
Thank you, Rick.
And again, the website, if you want to visit the website, madeinusaforever.com, I strongly suggest take a look at it. Todd, it's always great talking with you. I appreciate it.
My pleasure, Rick. Thank you. Call me anytime.
I most certainly will. I'm going to take a quick break. Right back. 1-888-520-RICK. 1-888-520-7425. This is The Rick Smith Show. We're working people. Come to talk. We got to do it today.
You're listening to The Rick Smith Show.
Would you die?
You're listening to the best of The Rick Smith Show. Enjoy your holiday.
January of 1964 was a time to remember for many Americans. The Beatles released their first album. New York announced plans to build a World Trade Center. The Surgeon General announced smoking kills, and President Lyndon Johnson declared a war on poverty during his first State of the Union address. January 1964 was also a momentous year for the American truck drivers. The nation's truckers sold the first nationwide labor contract. The National Master Freight Agreement, covering some 450,000 truck drivers employed by 16,000 companies across the country, set a nationwide minimum wage of $3.33 per hour, or $23.63 in 2008, as well as providing health care and retirement benefits for all its members. The 1964 National Master Freight Agreement set a nationwide standard for working conditions, giving drivers a voice on the job and the power to stand up to abusive treatment, and eventually the ability to refuse to drive equipment the driver deemed unsafe. Led by labor visionary James R. Hoffa, this victory was the crowning achievement of the International Brotherhood of Teamsters as one of America's most influential unions. This landmark agreement created a framework for all national contracts to follow. Jimmy Hoffa, the man who famously quipped, "I may have many faults, being wrong is not one of them," was certainly right about the benefits, power, and influence of such a national agreement for workers, both union and non-union. Wages and benefits earned by truck drivers brought millions of hardworking men and women solidly into the middle class by rewarding hard work with a fair day's pay for a fair day's work. For generations, the National Master Freight Agreement served as the industry standard for all truck drivers, raising wages, improving benefits, and providing a safer workplace for drivers and the motoring public. Unfortunately, since the 1980 passage of trucking deregulation, the industry has resorted to cutthroat competition based on who is willing to work for less. In this environment, the National Master Freight Agreement has lost some of its power in lifting truck drivers out of low wage, no benefit, and hazardous conditions. Currently, many non-union truck drivers are earning at or near poverty wages while pushing legal limits. For many truckers, their pay is solely determined by the number of miles they drive. Breakdowns, time spent waiting to be loaded and unloaded, and other delays are shouldered by the driver, in most cases without compensation. 1964 and the years that followed has shown what can be accomplished by workers standing together. Perhaps the future will see resurgence in worker solidarity and the reemergence of a fair day's work, a fair day's pay. This Rick Smith Show Labor History Moment is brought to you by a grant from the Labor Education Center of IUP. For more information, go to www.therickSmithShow.com.
Hey,
Hey there, fellow working class heroes. I have some great news. You can now get the Rick Smith Show podcast on your iPhone, Android, BlackBerry, or Palm on demand and on the go. Get your class war to go by downloading the Stitcher app on your smartphone by going to Stitcher.com and search for The Rick Smith Show, or go to our website at TheRickSmithShow.com and click on our Stitcher button. Together we can and we will rebuild a prosperous working class and leave opportunity for our children.
Seems like things are kind of upside down. Choke the juice on water, tire of a round worm and cane. He's done it before, he can do it again. This train's coming to town like a hurricane.
Kane train.
Oh, did you see the videos of him singing with what was his name? Arizona Boy there. Huckleberry. No, Huckabee. That's him. Huckabee. Did you see them singing together?
There was a wonderful duet.
Oh, forgot.
There's Ebony and Ivory right there. The heck with Paul McCartney and Michael Jackson. No, we got Huck and Kane.
Huck and Kane. That sounds like something that'll hurt. That's going to leave a mark.
Oh, just mind-blowing. Anyway, welcome back to The Rick Smith Show. Questions, comments, something on your mind, email me, rick@therickssmithshow.com, or give us a call, 1-888-520-RICK, 1-888-520-7425.
Now, I wore my shirt just for you today, even though it's very worn out and it belongs in a frame somewhere.
Feminist is the radical notion that women are
people.
People.
That said...
Are they really people?
Yeah. That said, the whole Herman Cain thing is very important, because when Herman Cain was accused of literally hurting a woman, restraining her, shoving her in a couch, pushing her around, trying to literally physically manhandle her into obeying his whim as the head of the Restaurant Association, whatever the heck he was the head of, right? Nobody cared. It wasn't hurting his reputation. When they found out he actually had sex, and Ginger White comes out and says, well, sex was really bad, but the money was good. With friends like that, Herman, you don't need enemies. That's when his career ends.
Yeah, well.
Wiener. Oh, praise heaven, Wiener's back, running for mayor in New York City. Are you kidding me? He didn't even take his underpants off. He texted his junk, and it was still wrapped.
Yeah.
This destroys careers. How can this be?
Because we're idiotic.
It's just sexuality. It's what you're supposed to be. You're supposed to be sexual. Now, if you want to be an elevated thinker...
No.
Supposed to be...
I haven't heard that many no's since I was married.
Top button. Chastity belt.
Oh, good Lord. I mean, just don't care. They're all going to have sex, okay? They might
no,
be...
No, not our politicians, no. Oh. They're too busy screwing us.
Really? No, really. Let them. Don't care about it. It's between them and their wives. How about Elliot Spitzer?
Number nine.
$5,000? I can't think of anything you could do for $5,000 unless you did it 500 times. $5,000?
Are you telling me something here?
$5 in fucking town. No, but
what? You gotta wonder, man. I knew a guy who got wrapped up.
I have this friend. Is that one of those stories?
Yeah, I knew a guy. You know, I worked as a bouncer in a bar in Cleveland, you know, a number of years back. One of these, these punk club kind of places. And a guy had gotten caught up in this prostitution ring. Mm-hmm. Sunday Lamb was the woman who was the prostitute who had this book of all of these guys.
Oh,
and his name was on it. He was one of the Browns players. And he said, I didn't pay her all that money for sex. I paid her to go home.
So he didn't have to chew his own arm off?
Yeah. No.
nothing's worth him waking up
and
in
the
bed with
an arm. And the paternity suits and all of the other things that come along with it. And for me, I don't care. I go back to the George Carlin thing. If selling's legal, and obviously sex is legal, why isn't selling sex legal?
I don't know. If I can, if you can videotape me having sex, and that's legal, and pay me, right? That's pornography, legal. It's the First Amendment. Why doesn't the First Amendment cover the fact that I could sell? And if I can give it away, why can't I sell it? Like, I'm setting the price. Free or not free. Right? It's just absurd. It's this. And then who cares?
Again, this is where my view on this whole thing, what you do within the confines of your four walls with consenting adults, that's your business. I don't care. And it goes back to my view. The old man, my grandfather had this, you know, had this saying, you know, you've got the right to do whatever it is you want to do until your right infringes on mine. And on any issue, I don't care what you do as long as it doesn't affect me or my kids. And I think that goes for just about most people. So be a decent human.
No. It doesn't go for just about. My mother used to say, if you were talking about anything that you weren't supposed to be talking about, my mother would say, get your mind out of the gutter. Get your mind out of the gutter. Now, if you're thinking about what two consenting adults do, and one of them does not happen to have a uterus, and you're obsessed with that, and you want to stop them, and you certainly don't want them to get married.
Yeah, good point.
You're thinking of stuff that's none of your business.
Yeah.
And at that point, your mind's in the gutter, and why are you thinking about that?
Well, probably because you're thinking, boy, I'd like to be there.
Yeah, maybe. Yeah, you're repressing your own.
I mean, how many, you remember the good pastor, Ted Haggard?
Oh, yes.
Pastor Ted?
Yeah.
Was the head of the evangelical group and was out with one of the most powerful guys in the country pushing for legislation to criminalize a homosexuality. There he is, sniffing crack off the back of a male hooker.
There's like 5,000 crack jokes there. I just am going to not do any of them. But, or Senator Craig.
Lusty Larry?
Yeah. You know, my brother-in-law, who's an MD, a doctor, a highly educated man, he said he spent about 3 days trying to figure out how that man could have a wide stance. Because this is what he said, right? Oh, I didn't really tap my foot under the other stall. I just have a wide stance.
Yeah,
so my
I'm
brother-in-law,
sure
the MD, doctor, highly educated man, says, that does it. I want to see how wide I can get my legs. So he goes into the bathroom. He sits down.
And he gets arrested?
No. He can't get his legs apart because his pants are around his ankles. So he says he had to have his pants off.
Oh, well, there you go. Or maybe he's just got a wide waist.
Or maybe he had him up, and he was just tapping his foot, and he's like Morse coding for sex.
There is that. But my all-time favorite, and this will never leave me as long as I live, a guy named Bob Allen. He was a state senator from Florida, a state representative in Florida, the head of the McCain election campaign, you know, way up there in the McCain camp. He was walking through the park one day. It began to rain. The rain turned to thunder. The thunder scared him. He ran to the nearest public bathroom. You know how they have those? You know, those
yeah.
Ran in, saw a very... Now, understand, obviously frightened from the thunder. The rain got him a little wet. So
maybe a chill.
Chill, there you go.
Yeah.
So he's frightened already. He runs into the bathroom, and there, a large black man.
Embraces him and keeps him warm.
Just a big, scared out of his mind from the thunder and the large black man imposing his will on him. Mr. Allen offers to pay him for sex.
really, no.
So
let me pay you. This is good stuff.
So you look at this and you go, and now this gets better, because you know normally don't care.
Right.
If you're going to be some idiot, you know, that's what you do. God bless you. Do what you got to do.
Right.
But Mr. Allen was a legislator.
Mm-hmm.
Every year that Mr. Allen was in the Florida legislature, proposed a piece of legislation making that a felony. And I go, you know, what kind of self-loathing, what kind of self-hatred does someone like this have to? And this is my problem with any of those people who point their finger and go, you.
Yep.
Like, as my mom always said, you know, you point that one, you got three going back at you.
Well, it's actually, I write for the Huffington Post, and I wrote a Huffington Post about the self-loathing Republicans. And Governor Paul LePage of Maine, who is the latest in the long string of self-loathing Republicans. And this time it's not about sexuality, because this guy hops to Jamaica anytime he wants and has whatever good time he wants to have, and he makes no bones about it. Possibly a bad choice of words. So, but this guy hates the poor. This guy who was homeless, who ran away from home because his father beat him so badly, he and his family and his mother, horrible victims of domestic violence, just horrible, horrible domestic violence. He is homeless at 12. People take him in. They offer to take care of him. A college in Maine, because of his extenuating circumstances, his extreme poverty, and his inability to speak English, allows him to take his entrance exams in another language. And now he's a Tea Party Republican who's caught Head Start.
Pulled myself up by the bootstraps.
Can't stand people who don't speak English, even though at college level he had to take his college, and they made a special exception for him to take his college entrance exams in another language.
Pulled myself up by my bootstraps.
It's self-loathing. It's the self-loathing ridiculousness.
I got up the ladder. Now it's time to saw it in half.
My favorite Paula Page is, though, he took down the labor mural in Maine. He did all these other things. My favorite thing was when he dissed the NAACP on Martin Luther King Jr. Day. And he said, look, you can't pick on me for this, dissing the NAACP. My son is black. Okay? He's got a black son, he says. Turns out he brought a 21-year-old black guy back from Jamaica who happened to be his caddy. He actually never adopted him. He just brought the caddy home, and in order to keep him in the country, because he's a damn fine caddy.
Got guardianship. Nice.
This is a governor. Yeah, sponsorship.
Nice.
Governor of a state in the United States of America. Boggles the mind. And we care about sex? Have sex. I want everybody within the sound of Rick Smith's voice to have sex tonight. Just go have it. Realize it's not a big deal. In fact, embrace the idea.
You know, since you brought that up, you know, that's one of those things that catches my attention, you know, because that self-loathing, that pointing the finger in the whole caddy thing reminded me of Ted Nugent.
You know the nice thing about Ted Nugent? We all hate him, too.
Yeah, I still love the story about how he wet himself and, you know, he soiled his pants so he didn't have to go into the army. Yeah. But the whole guardianship thing caught my attention because evidently he was, you know, doing whatever, that thing with a 17-year-old girl while he was, and he actually got guardianship of his girlfriend. This is well documented. This is not something that I'm making up out of the air.
What a predatory pig.
And you go, really?
Yeah. Well, because he was a very grown man at this time, right?
Yeah, well. I look at it and I go, you know, I got to be honest. You know, my daughter, I'm killing somebody.
You know that the average child under the age of 15 who gets pregnant is made pregnant by a man over the age of 19.
And generally aren't they generally aren't rock musicians.
No, probably many times they're family members. But so this whole, like, hating the young girls who get pregnant thing, it's predatory, it's not consensual. What we're talking about here is like Herman Cain and Ginger White, you know, consensual. And probably prostitution, because she kept saying, you know, the sex was lousy but the money was good. Sounds like a transaction to me.
So I guess it was 1978 that it happened. That was different. It was back in the 70s.
You know? 78, so how old is he now?
He was born in 48.
So he was 30.
He was 30. She was 17. Ah, that's all right.
Oh, God.
Nuts. Anyway, if you missed any portion of the program, therickssmithshow.com, that's where you get the podcast. Stitcher on your smartphone. Take the program on the go. Remember, you can follow us on Twitter, like us on Facebook. Quick break. Back with Hour 3.
Exposing that free trade is never free. The Rick Smith Show.
You are listening to the best of The Rick Smith Show. Enjoy your holiday.
It's The Rick Smith Show on Country Gold Radio, WIOO Carlisle, and WEEO Shippensburg.
You're listening to WIN, Workers Independent News, a production of Diversified Media Enterprises. I'm Doug Cunningham. AFSCME Medical Center workers in California began a two-day strike Tuesday. Jesse Russell reports.
All five University of California medical centers saw picket lines on Tuesday as workers walked off the job over stalled contract negotiations. It was the first day of a planned two-day strike brought on by employees demanding a contract that includes fair wages and an increased commitment to patient safety. Margaret Mann is a hospital lab tech at UC San Francisco's Medical Center.
Since, I think, last June, we've been working without a contract, and the university is, they're just not paying attention to any of our concerns at all.
Representatives of the UC system have criticized the strike action as putting patients in the middle of a labor dispute. But Mann said they took the action as a last resort.
You know, as far as the patients in there today, we have to deal with them 365 days a year. You know, we care about them 365 days a year. And if this is the only way we can make things better, and this is the action of last resort, we have tried everything. Nobody wanted to do this.
The workers are represented by the American Federation of State, County, and Municipal Employees, Local 3299. But they weren't the only workers on the strike lines. The University Professional and Technical Workers, Local 9119, launched a sympathy strike and marched along with their co-workers. UPT workers said they shared the same concerns regarding rising executive salaries, while workers are asked to accept concessions to patient care.
In Washington, D.C., federal workers protesting low wages walked off their jobs at several federal buildings. The workers have organized as Good Jobs Nation. They work for federal contractors at the Ronald Reagan Building, the Smithsonian, Union Station, and other buildings. The federal government is the largest employer of low-wage workers in America, with some 2 million low-wage workers working for the government through contractors paid for by tax money. Those workers want a real living wage. Low-wage workers are rising up, fighting for living wages and union organizing rights all over America, from New York City to Walmart warehouses in California and Chicago to Detroit, St. Louis, and Milwaukee, to name just a few. Jennifer Epps Addison is with the Milwaukee Workers Organizing Committee.
It really just comes from everyday working people who are doing everything they can and doing everything right, doing exactly what they were told they're supposed to do, and yet at the end of the week or at the end of the month, don't have enough to meet their basic needs. They can't keep their rent paid. They can't keep their lights on. And most importantly, they can't take care of their children. And so folks really came together and they started talking about their conditions. We were inspired by what's happening across the country. And so we decided that we needed to turn those poverty wage jobs into good jobs, into jobs that could support a family.
Workers Independent News is made possible in part through underwriting support from the International Brotherhood of Teamsters. You've been listening to WIN, Workers Independent News. For more information, visit laborradio.org.
Remembering that united we bargain, divided we beg. Rick Smith.
I gotta listen to fans, written on the palm of my hand. I'm on my listen, you got no right hand. Feeling an anthem, stop to want a piece of body. See somebody, try to free somebody. Gotta listen to fans.
So thousands of University of California patient care workers went on strike today. Nurses, surgical and x-ray techs, custodians, you know, the people who clean up, the cooks, you know, the people who do all of the work in the hospital on strike today. What was one of the number one things? Staffing levels. Looking at the fact that, you know, a lot of these hospitals in this situation, some unsanitary conditions in operating tables, broken equipment, chronic understaffing. And, of course, hospitals that are not being reinvested in or deteriorating. And, you know, this is the kind of stuff that I think is important. And we keep hearing people say, well, you know, those greedy people go on strike for money. Uh-uh. Not these teachers. And very few strikes are about money, just to let you in on the secret, even though that's what the media keeps telling us. That's why I've asked Randy Johnson. He's an MRI tech there. Also, he's one of the bargaining team members. I'll talk about today's strike and basically what they're asking for. Randy, thanks for taking time for me.
Thank you.
So today's event, what kind of turnout did you get?
We have a large turnout. We're not really sure at the exact numbers, but we had thousands across the state of California at all five medical centers. It was a huge turnout. This is the first time the patient care technical unit has actually really gone on strike. We've sympathy striked before, but it was an extremely successful couple of days, we think.
Well, to me, anytime you draw attention to conditions, as I've read, are unsanitary operating tables, I got to be honest. You know, as somebody who's been in surgery within the last year, I want to make sure that that's clean. I don't pick up some weird, funky disease and end up killing me, because infections, and I'm sure you know, one of the leading causes of people dying in hospitals.
Well, yeah, that is correct. I mean, I don't work in the operating room, but I do know that they really have cut down on the amount of housekeeping personnel that we have in the hospital.
My profit.
And it makes it much more difficult. They have a lot more square footage to clean.
Yeah, that cleaning, all that cleaning and that unnecessary stuff, it just takes away from profit, Randy. And we need to have more profit.
Well, that seems to be the way that this nonprofit organization wants to go. Our CEO, Mark Larratt, makes about $1.1 million a year. He just got a $300,000, well, he's getting a $300,000 retention bonus. And just last month, well, in March, he eliminated 300 jobs. And what's really ridiculous about this is that we are actually opening another medical center on February 2014.
I saw something that said that the executives that work for UC Medical, the University of California Medical System, the executives there since 2009 have racked up, what is it, $100 million in compensation?
Yes. More. I mean, that's not, they get a lot more than 100. It's more than $100 million. It's $100 million more.
More. Wow,
more.
That's even more egregious and outrageous than I thought, because to me, I look at that $100 million in just the last 4 years and go, that's $100 million of health care that people in the community are not getting. It's $100 million that's not being put back into the hospital, not putting into buying new equipment, not putting into making sure the operating rooms are clean and sanitary. That seems to me to be a huge misplacement of priorities.
It absolutely is. I don't have the exact number. I don't have those numbers in front of me right now. But I believe that the top level compensation is about $300 million a year.
Wow. So what are they telling you as you're sitting at the bargaining table? What are they telling you? You know, hey, we're making $300 million. We're lining our pockets, but sorry, we're going to have to lay you off and pay cuts, and I'm sure a lot of the other things that we hear. What are they saying?
Well, honestly, I just shake my head at the bargaining table. They're not denying that. But they're just saying that that the university isn't interested in giving you language to stop the contracting out of jobs. The university isn't interested in making these per diem employees, which is as needed, but they're actually working full-time hours. They're not interested in giving them benefits that would give them health care insurance. And what really amazes me, and I don't think this is just UC, I think this is a trend in hospitals, which, you know, I've been in this business for over 20 years. I've never seen it like this kind of atmosphere, but it seems to me it's like of all places that should want their employees to have health care benefits should be a hospital.
Yeah, and you would think.
And the amount of per diems they're using now as full-time employees is outrageous. In our particular hospital at UCSF Medical Center, I work at University of California San Francisco Medical Center, and our respiratory therapists, they started using a lot of contracting out, using a...
So we're getting temp service. You're going to get temp workers.
It is basically a temp service. They call it registry. And these people, I mean, they've gone through school, but they're new graduates. They haven't had a chance to be truly trained. And they're coming in, and the University of California, especially at San Francisco and UCLA, we do things that nobody else does. And our patients are often much more, the acuity is much more at a higher level. They're much sicker. And so these people come in, and they're only there a few days at a time, and you lose the continuity of care. And continuity of care is so important for these people. So they, according to the respiratory therapist, there have been some mistakes made. Luckily, nobody has actually gotten seriously hurt, but who knows when that will happen.
No.
But also because of their short staffing and their inadequate staff quality of the people that they're using, they have to triage what treatments are going to get done and what treatments aren't going to get done.
That's no way to run a hospital. That's no way to care
treatment.
For people.
Yeah. So, but we had a patient today that spoke at our rally that she's been a patient at UCSF for 15 years. And she's just, like, really upset about the fact that we don't have that they're using so much temporary help, and they're using, and that she, in, like, she made a very good observation. She said, you know, Mark Lareret walks down the street, I probably wouldn't know who he was. However, I know who my phlebotomist is. I know who my nurses are. I know who the technologist and the radiation treatment therapist people are that take care of me. I know these people because I've been doing this for 15 years. And what she's seeing is she's starting to see a lot of new faces, and then they come and go.
And that's an excellent point, because, you know, to me, it's about having that continuity of care and that consistency. And what I see happening in the healthcare industry, and it's not taking care of people, it's an industry, is this high turnover, this chronic understaffing, that you have no consistency and no regularity. And it's like factory work, where we'll plug this person in here and fill this hole, and it's just pumping out little widgets.
Well, they've actually said that they want a variable workforce, which really what they're really saying is they want a disposable workforce.
Exactly.
And, you know, that, and the head of the labor relations of the entire UC system, Dwayne Duckett, used to be the head of Kraft North American Labor Relations. And, you know, so my thing I said to him is, like, you know, a variable workforce may work when you're bottling ketchup or mayonnaise. It doesn't work when you're taking care of people or taking care of patients.
See, that's the problem. You've got a guy who comes from making mac and cheese to running a healthcare system, and you go, wait a second, what happened to the days when doctors ran healthcare systems? Why is it that we've got now MBAs and lawyers doing it instead of the people who actually know how to care for people?
Well, that's exactly right. The people who are making these decisions on cutting the staff, using contract work,
they're bean counters.
They're bean counters. They've never, ever touched a patient, and they have no idea what we go through. And the point is, it's like they never will know. If they come in as a patient, we are ordered to drop whatever we're doing and just handle them with kit gloves. You know, and so they just, like, get cooed over, and you know, the Regents is the governing board that oversees the university, and they really have the power. And when Jerry Brown, the governor Jerry Brown, came to one of the Regent meetings, he's just really disgusted on how much the CEOs are making and all the executives are making. And I swear to God, this Regent, I can't remember her name, I'm sorry, but she came out of her mouth was, well, they have families. And I don't know about you, but if I was going to, I would love to try to raise the family just 1 year for that $1.1 million.
That's jaw-dropping. That is literally a jaw-dropping statement. Well, there's nothing to say other than, are you bleepity-bleep insane?
Exactly.
I mean, there's nothing else I can come up with, and I can't believe anyone would have the audacity to come out with that.
Well, and the governor was just like, he's just so disgusted with them on this. And so it's just everything about this is, you know, it's about their thing is about the pension plan. And by the way, our pension plan is 80% funded, which is not in danger of
nope.
anyone's imagination.
It's close to the green area.
But what they want to do is they're touting that we're not accepting the pension plan, and everybody's got new pension plans. And I have two things to say about that. First of all, they're exempting themselves. The executives won't be affected by the new pension plan. They refuse to put a cap on it. Right now, Mark Udoff, which is the president of the university, he's retiring in August, and he's retiring with over $300,000 a year for the rest of his life coming out of our pension.
Yeah, but Randy,
his health care.
Randy, he's got a family.
Well, you know, no, he's
got grandkids.
Grown and gone.
He's got grandkids. He's got to worry about his great grandkids.
Well, you know what? If they want to give us that pension plan, we'll sign on the dotted line right now.
I'd be right there with you. So let me ask you: there's 2 days of action, the on strike for these 2 days. What are you hoping to gain? Is this to get people to say, "Hey, we're serious. Get back to the table," and maybe start to hopefully get some serious negotiations going? Where do you hope this goes after tomorrow?
Well, I think what we're gaining from this, several things here. First of all, we have proven that we are serious, meaning business. And And I want to talk a bit about how the membership just really came together, and people who were, when they first came out online, were timid and scared. They ended up, they were beating drums and just having excited. What we really want to get out of this is, like, our director, she compares it to a prize fighter. And so when we've had these little lunch rallies and stuff, that's like a jab, that's a jab, that's a jab. And then when you have this two-day strike, that's a punch. You know, we've given them a black eye, but we haven't knocked them out. Right. And we realize that. But we want to bring public awareness. We want to bring awareness to our legislators, which are overwhelmingly on our side. And we just want to, and we want to let UC know that we're in this for the long haul. We're in this for the long fight. So, you know, get prepared. There will be no peace. There will be no labor peace until we get a contract that we find that's acceptable, that takes care of our patients, takes care of our families.
I love hearing that kind of empowerment, because what you were saying, they were timid at first, and then when they joined together and they came together, they felt empowered. That's the word that I use, because, you know, that's what we need to make sure of. And here's the thing, Randy, when you guys do knock them out, I know each and every one of you people, there'll be the healthcare professionals you are, will be there to take care of them and mend their black eyes.
Well, we will try.
There you go. Randy Johnson, I appreciate the time, brother.
Okay, I appreciate it. Thank you so much.
Quick break, right back. 1-888-520-RICK. 1-888-520-7425.
You're listening to The Rick Smith Show.
Whenever one of our cities gets a star turn as host of some super sparkly event, such as a national political gathering or a Super Bowl, its first move is to tidy up by having the police sweep homeless people into jail, out of town, or under some rug. But the tidy uppers of Houston, Texas, aren't waiting for a world-class event to rationalize going after homeless down-and-outers. They preemptively outlawed the crime of dumpster diving. In March, James Kelly, a 44-year-old Navy veteran, was passing through Houston on his way to connect with family in California. Homeless, destitute, and hungry, he chose to check out the dining delicacies in a trash bin near City Hall. Spotted by police, Kelly was promptly charged with, quote, disturbing the contents of a garbage can in the Central Business District. Seriously, I was just basically looking for something to eat, he told the Houston Chronicle. But unbeknownst to both this indigent tourist and the great majority of Houston's generally generous citizens, an ordinance dating way back to 1942 says that, quote, molesting garbage containers is illegal. Also, in 2012, city officials made it a crime for any group to hand out food to the needy in the downtown area without first getting a permit. It's a cold use of legal authority to chase the homeless away to, well, anywhere else. Such laws are part of an effort throughout the country to criminalize what some call homeless behavior. And sure enough, when hungry, the behavioral tendency of a homeless human is to seek a bite of nourishment, often in such dining spots as dumpsters. The homeless behavior that Houston has outlawed then is eating. This is Jim Hightower saying, when Houstonians learned of Kelly's rude experience, many reached out to help him get through his hard times. Now they need to reach out to local politicos and get the city's hard treatment of homeless people changed.
To get more of Jim Hightower's populist take on what Wall Street and Washington are up to, visit www.hightowerlowdown.org.
You are listening to the best of the Rick Smith Show. Enjoy your holiday. AFSCME Council 13 members, did you know that you have voluntary benefits available to you that you can pay for through the ease of payroll deduction? AFSCME Council 13 offers a voluntary benefits package to help provide money when you or a covered family member incurs one of these life events, accidents, critical illness, disability, or death. No one can avoid life's unfortunate situations. However, AFSCME Council 13 has provided you with the opportunity to ease the financial burden on your family by preparing now. Find out more about Trustmark's voluntary benefits. BBS Benefit Solutions can help you get the security you need. Call BBS at 1-866-902-2561. Again, call BBS at 1-866-902-2561.
The Rick Smith Show.
The walls come crumbling down. The walls come crumbling, crumbling. The walls.
A couple of bits of good news, Pat.
Some good things, I think. And you know, we talked a little bit some downer things, but some good news. I look at Minnesota on Monday night. They came through with, in the House of Representatives there in Minnesota, they've come through with a piece of legislation that's going to allow in-home child care and personal care workers in the state of Minnesota to unionize, to organize, to say, you know what, if we're taking care of children and if we're taking care of the disabled, maybe we should be able to afford to feed ourselves and take care of ourselves. To me, all of this seems to be just kind of fundamental.
Well, and it's very important because what people don't understand is that these child care providers that have to organize, they aren't organizing against private employers. What they're organizing against is the government payment of
poverty.
Right. Yeah. So if you are in the Aspire program because you're getting temporary aid for needy families, then you are required to get a job or to volunteer and put your kid in daycare. Stupidest thing I've ever heard, but that's okay. I'll keep moving. Then once your kid goes into daycare, the government not only pays your TANF payment, but also pays the daycare. And the way the government saves money is to pay poverty wages to the daycare provider. And so the government is teaching a whole pile of bad lessons here. A daycare provider is better than a mommy. And I'm not saying they aren't. I'm not saying that working mothers aren't a wonderful thing. But the purpose of welfare originally was to let parents raise their own children while they were impoverished. And then secondly...
No, it was to punish them and make them work because they're lazy and drug addicts.
Even if they have to just volunteer and bring no money into the house, they have to volunteer, and then their kid goes to a daycare provider, and the daycare provider is being used by the government.
And what's wrong with that?
It's become the American way, I'm afraid.
I mean,
but that is great news that they're going to organize, because now they'll have to say to the government, you have to pay us better.
But here's the thing. I mean, you look at the federal poverty line, which stands for a family of four at just over $23,000. What they're saying in Minnesota, the median wage for a personal care aide, you know, someone who takes care of your grandmother while she's, instead of putting her into a nursing home, she can somewhat take care of herself at home, mm-hmm. but needs help. The average wage for someone, the median wage for someone like that is about $19,000. A child care worker, you know, the people who take care of our most precious future asset, about $19,000. So you're talking about, they're making about $19,000 a year, where the federal poverty line is $23,500 for a family of four. And, you know, it goes back to what we talked about last night, this scorecard from the Wider Opportunity for Women group, who found Pennsylvania C-. No state got an A, by the way.
Mm-hmm.
None of them. A couple got B minuses. That's about it. Everybody else in the C minus, couple with D's, and you wouldn't be shocked by who the D's were: Tennessee, Mississippi, Alabama, Utah. Wouldn't be shocked by that. I guess, you know, what I was surprised is that Florida actually had a C, and you know, Florida actually has universal pre-K programs, preschool programs, that, you know, all kids get to go. And, you know, your former state, where you used to live up in Maine, has now just passed some legislation that they may be the next state, along with the Florida, the Georgia, Oklahoma, Illinois, New York, and West Virginia, who offer preschool universally.
Well, the legislature passed it,
but your governor...
But Governor LePage isn't going to sign that.
Yeah, they said the biggest hurdle is going to be... Mr. LePage.
Yeah, he's going to absolutely. He's the one who just recently, along with when he had a Republican legislature, which, oh, by the way, the people of Maine spanked and sent home. While he had a Republican legislature, he eliminated, like, an enormous percentage of Head Start. So
nice.
He really doesn't want kids to get anything. Anything. You know, I have some good news. Did you see Tesla Motors?
Yep.
Has paid off their loan. How many was it? 5-8 years early? The electronic automaker borrowed almost $500 million from the Department of Energy in 2010. The $451.8 million wire transfer went through today. And the United States taxpayers made a $12 million profit lending them the money.
Now, how dare we invest in companies? How dare we?
They created 60,000 jobs. And they put out a electric model that has received a 99 out of a possible 100 from Consumer Reports.
Now, the problem is I can't afford it.
Yeah, that is a problem for you.
They're really expensive.
But the thing that you can sleep well tonight is knowing that you made $12 million lending them the money. Just like if we were willing to pay for educations, you could make money on the increased taxes the highly educated people would pay.
Or in funding universal pre-K programs.
Right.
Because we know that for every dollar you spend on a universal on a pre-K program, it returns about $7 in dividends.
Or in universal health care. If we invested in universal health care, you'd save a fortune. It amazes me that people think they don't pay for health care if they don't have health insurance. When you register your car, you pay for the health insurance of the person that works at the registry. You pay when you pay your homeowner's policy. I mean, not your homeowner's policy, but your property taxes. You pay for the health insurance of your sheriff. I mean, you pay for health insurance over and over and over and over again, and you don't ever count it in as an insurance payment. So when you really think about what we pay, it's amazing. Amazing. Do you have more happy news?
I actually do. I actually have some fairly good news. The Texas legislature passed a major Buy American measure. And you go, Texas? Yeah, Texas. They're saying, you know...
Wait a minute, I thought you said Texas.
I did, I said Texas.
Wow.
They passed House Bill number 4. It's going to include a requirement that iron and steel products and manufactured goods used on any of their products, on any of their projects, produced in the U.S.
Wow.
In fact, it was passed 141-4 in the House and 30-1 in the Senate. Any of their major construction projects. Because, you know, even Texas is getting it. And I keep, you know, some of the people I know in Texas start saying, hey, they've been telling me, watch out, Texas is going to be the next California. Because the people are waking up to the reality that the Bushes of the world and the Rick Perrys of the world have got their heads so far up their keisters that they're struggling. And when we got a guy like Tom Corbett saying, well, we want to be the Texas of the Northeast. Yeah.
That's because Texas doesn't want to be Texas anymore. Texas wants to be California so Pennsylvania can become Texas.
So I look at this and I go, you know.
Ann Richards from Texas? Yep. She was fabulous.
She was fabulous.
Molly Ivins.
Big hair.
Yeah.
Loved her gun too, though. Yeah. I guess in Texas you have to.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm not anti-gun. You know, I'm just, you know, I'm very much, never mind. Never mind. But anyway, they passed this and then, to me, you know, domestic production, domestic consumption. And if we're building a bridge here in Pennsylvania, shouldn't it be made with stuff from the U.S.? Should we be shipping in concrete from China when we've got a perfectly good concrete manufacturer outside of Allentown? Should we bring in the steel from anywhere else when you've got steel being made in Pittsburgh or, you know, right here?
Do they still make steel in Pittsburgh?
In fact, they make more steel now than they did in their heyday.
Wow.
They're just doing it with a lot less people because they went and they upgraded all of their capacity. And, you know, you go back into the, you know, the 60s and 70s, they were using antiquated technology then. And I remember my ex-wife's father was a foreman there at Bethlehem Steel in Bethlehem for years and years. And he said, you know, back in the 60s, the Japanese and the Germans were coming
right
over to learn, you know, how we made steel. And they were mocking us then because their technology, thanks to the Marshall Plan, because we invested in their industries, and, of course, Bethlehem Steel and a lot of the big companies did, too, to get away from here. Because, hey, if we can get cheap, exploitable labor, we're going to do it. And they had technology far superior. So this idea that it was those rich union workers who destroyed. No, it was Bethlehem Steel buying golf courses and hotels instead of investing in technology to keep their industry going.
You know, it's interesting you say that, too, though, because almost every piece of windmill technology, the equipment, we import from Germany. If we're going to build windmills in the United States, we get the stuff from Germany. Germany doesn't have low wages.
They're very high wages.
Yeah. And they
heavily
have,
unionized.
And they have universal everything.
And more importantly than all of that, they actually have workers who sit on their corporate boards.
That's
So as I've always said, look, if you're not at the table, mm-hmm. you're on the menu. Here, there in Germany, the workers are sitting at the table. Guess who's not on the menu? The workers.
Yeah.
And I've advocated for some time of, I would like to, as a matter of law, like it is in Germany, that your board has to have a member on there, has mm-hmm. to have somebody who does that job. And, you know, what I find really amusing, and you know, we had talked a minute ago about preschool. The preschool that we send my daughter to just fired a teacher that they had for 25 years.
Wow.
This preschool has been around for 42 years, and 25 of those years, this woman was a teacher there, and there was never any problem. Until she had the audacity, the unmitigated gall, to say, you know what, we, the teachers, the people who deal with these kids, we should have a voice in what the kids learn.
No. Oh, that's crazy. Like, what would she know about kids learning? She's only been a teacher for 25 years.
Like we used to.
Yeah.
And what's going on, and this is really, when I saw the email exchange and all of this coming out, and I said, you know, this is really what's happened on a much larger scale. This is just a very small little microcosm of the larger problem. You get these people who don't know what it is to be a teacher or know nothing about education sitting on these boards, be it school boards or the preschool board or whatever, and they've got this vision of, oh, well, you know, we're going to tell you what to do, even though we don't have a clue of what it is you do.
Mm-hmm.
And when the teacher says, hey, you know, things are getting really out of hand. These last couple of years, your experiment of moving us away, kind of out of hand. We need to get, you know, back to having some continuity, maybe talking about curriculum and stuff, you know, maybe just a thought. No. You and your other one, you're both fired.
Unbelievable.
But, you know, hey.
And it's all for, I mean, she's not doing that for herself. She's doing it for the children. And that's the other person who's not at that table, by the way, child.
And my daughter just adores her.
Yeah.
And, you know, all the kids did. And, you know, it's not like the board came back and said, well, she was a crummy teacher. She, you know, she failed. No, they said she basically had the audacity to say she wanted some say.
She was uppity.
And guess what? There's not a damn thing she can do about it.
You guys could, though.
Not
as parents?
I'm considering not sending her back, but you know, she wouldn't have been my kid's teacher anyway. But the reality is this is what happens when you have no voice, no say. Mm-hmm. And you know what I tell those teachers at that school? Organize. Get a contract. Because there's nothing that woman can do for being fired. Nothing.
Yeah.
And I'm considering stirring some things up because, you know, to me it's just outrageous. That this board would say, well, we're going to fire her because she had the audacity to want to sit with us.
Well, I've always said that homeless shelters should have homeless people on the board, too. You know, I mean, how can you actually...
What do they know about being homeless?
Yeah. And, you know, the homeless people make it look so damn easy. I mean, how tough does it really look when you're watching a homeless person be homeless? But it's a lot tougher.
Oh, no, I've played it.
Yeah.
I did that whole 8 days in a cardboard box. It's difficult. And there are some things that, you know, in that experience. And we're going to try and do the hungry and homeless again. I'm just not sure in which way. But there are a couple of things that are going to completely stick with me and haunt me for some time. One of it was the guy who had been homeless for a couple of years who we had given a box to stay with us. And he said, you know, those 4 or 5 days he stayed with us, the safest he's felt in years.
Mm.
And you don't think about that. I mean, I never thought about my safety.
Oh, when you were playing homeless?
Yeah, never thought about it.
Yeah.
And the world that this guy exposed me to, completely different than anything that I had conceived.
If you were in a shelter, you'd worry more about your safety. Because shelters are so full of disease.
And that's what they said.
And, I mean, really, Pennsylvania, what Governor Corbett and all the rest of it and the sequester is doing to housing. The housing situation in Pennsylvania is awful, absolutely awful. Same thing he's doing to education. It's the same thing. The problem is, in spite of that, I guess the good news is, but it's a big...